Good morning, everyone. Coming to you live from somewhere in the Middle East, it is Saturday morning's hottest streaming media political talk show, Inside the Eye, live with The Fedge.
If it was up to me, I'd dump the Israelis tomorrow.
Heck, did I just hear someone tell a standing member of Congress that if it were up to them, they would dump the Israelis tomorrow? Sounds like something you might hear right here on Inside the Eye Live.
The Fetch. What a man. Oh, my God. You have to listen to that show. He was brilliant. I didn't know he had gonads of steel like that and a mind like a frigging razor. I didn't realize he was so clear. He cut through this that cognitive dissonance that is going on in the whole Patriot music movement.
And now it's time for Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware.
Happy wacky Saturday. And we're going to try to turn this down here. And you are listening to Inside the Eye Live with Mr. Dennis Fetcho. I'm not Dennis Fetcho. Mr. Dennis Fetcho is out doing secret squirrel stuff, and so he asked me and Mr. Woody to fill in for him today. So we are going to bring in Mr. Woody now and say hi on a Saturday.
Hey, baby. How you doing?
Good. Yeah, sounding good. Going out to the chat room to see what they say. They're my ears. Okay. Trying to get the cues right. And still can't hear, you know, the bumper music in my headphones when I call in on Skype. So we're having to tap dance around that a little bit. But I think they're going to take care of us there at the studio.
Okay. There is a big delay.
Yes, there really is. Okay, so moving out to the chat room here. Yeah, they say we're coming in loud and clear. I think my mic might be a little bit hotter than yours, so I'm going to try to bring you up a little bit here. So how's it going out where you are today? And introduce yourself so everybody knows who we are here. So you go ahead.
Okay. You know me as Woody. I've been on for Dennis a few times, and I've called in and did some interviews with him a few times about different things. Just a general guy like Dennis, and, you know, just staying involved in the what's going on this planet.
The awakened here, the great awakening. I like that. Yeah. I've guest hosted a few times for The Fetch, and I have the show Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Clubs for the folks who don't know me. And that's on Wednesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time. And fun fact for the newbies, The Fetch was the first person to actually give me a platform. And that came from me calling into his show back during the Oracle days. And him, we chatted and invited me to come back on, and we did the interview that started it all, you know. And so that's, you know, how far back the Fetch and I go here on these troll wars.
Oh yeah, I go back with Fetch probably before he even went to Oracle. I found Fetch through his esoteric work.
Yeah, a lot of people came in from the Illuminatus Observer, that aspect of it. And I came in, this is my favorite Fetch story, is I was over at another site on another network, you know, and the trolling the chat rooms, like, you know, and somebody says, "Have you ever heard this guy?" And I was like, "No." So they sent me the link and listened to it, and it happened to be the night of the Tuscan Tussle. And I was sitting here just almost ready to hurt myself. I'm laughing so hard at this when Bob Tuscan called in and tried to troll the Fetch, and it just blew up in his face, poor guy. Bless his heart. Yeah. And I was just like, yeah, I like this guy. Who is this guy?
Yeah. You don't troll the Fetch.
Yeah, bad move. They call him Troll Slayer for a reason. To the newbies, you know, that's a giveaway. You know, that's a tell. Don't mess with him.
Yeah, Bob Tuscan. I just looked up to see if Bob Tuscan's around. He seems to have a YouTube channel.
Yeah, he kind of fell off the scene there, you know, this year's model. Echo, echo, echo.
Oh, are you getting an echo?
No, I was just, that's how I said
it. Oh, I got you.
A certain tribe, and they always, you know, tell us who our new leaders are. These are your new Judas Goat leaders of the month, the flavor of the month, you know. Suddenly they're everywhere, and then they're nowhere, you know. There's no buildup, there's no decay. It's just, you know, what is it, flash in the pan kind of thing.
Yeah, well, Bob, let's see. I'm looking at his YouTube channel. He posted something 3 months ago, and then the last time before that was 2 years ago. So he doesn't seem to be as active as he used to be.
Yeah.
I think he got his pants all in a wad when Dennis tore them up for him.
Oh, yeah, that kind of started something. Yeah, that was the, you know, chat or the call heard around the world. I just felt the Overton window shift worldwide that night. I was like, yeah. Okay, we're now here.
You know, Dennis, he's probably listening, if he can. He always used to talk about his, you know, French likes his numbers, and that show with Bob is like so many views over the years. It's just unbelievable. It's just an extraordinary number of people that have hit that thing. I have to ask him. I don't know if they're still hitting it or not. Yeah.
Yeah,
probably need to bring it up again.
Yeah, for the newbies, if you have not heard it, or if you haven't heard it for a while, or in a while, I should say, you know, go back and listen to the Tuscan Tussle. It is a classic point in, you know, meme war history.
I think it's on it used to be on the front page or one of the
front page there, you know.
Yeah. So what are we going to talk about? What are we going to entertain with this office today? I mean, our audience.
Well, I was just tap dancing and I was going to be back up. I was going to play Dean Martin. I mean, I was going to play Jerry Lewis to your Dean Martin, you know.
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about, talk about current events right now. The things going on.
Yeah, what's on your radar? I mean, what's, you know.
Well, it's the same thing everybody else is probably watching. I mean, we've got, you know, Syria, the thing with Syria is a big deal. And, you know, Trump played them like a fiddle. I mean.
Oh, so that's what you're seeing with this. Because, you know, we were watching it like a ping pong match going, you know, organic, synthetic, you know, who are the players? What are they doing here? What's their end game? And, you know, who's coming out on top?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious Trump did. And what he did is that because Syria is in the, what do you call it? The NATO, is a member of NATO. So, what Trump did is that he knew that NATO would not come when he put those tariffs on him. I mean, that's when he backed down, and he had to because NATO, the other NATO members were not going to come and help him. And he knew this, you know, so the way he played it, it was pretty masterful. He just set it up. So he left Erdogan standing in front of him with his pants down around his ankles, basically.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, did you see the letter from the White House, that Trump sent to Erdogan?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. During the break, we need to like pull that up and just read a few lines from that letter. I was just like, at first I thought, okay, is somebody trolling me by sending me this? And then I actually go out to the White House. You know, I'm on their distribution list. So every time they send out something like that, you know, I get it. And sure enough, it was in the hamper. And then I went out and verified it. You know, and by then it had hit the mainstream media. And it's like, oh my God, that was a legit letter. And did you hear that Erdogan reaction, or do you think that was real, that he threw the fit and threw it in the trash? Or you think that was just propaganda?
You know what? I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah, that was the story. Yeah, you know, but it's like that was only like overhear some chatter, and then it kind of disappeared as everything developed so quickly, because that was just before you realized what was going on, it had just flashed and it settled. And you're just kind of like, what exactly was all of that? You know, there was so much going on in this little amount of time.
I just pulled it up, and here's the thing, how politically it's played. So I pulled up, you know, Trump's letter to Erdogan, and first one's NBC News, and it says Trump's headline is Trump's extraordinary letter to Turkey, and the next one's from HuffPost, and they said Trump pens bizarre letter to Erdogan.
Oh, bizarre. Okay. We need to circle back to a Huffington Post. I got a data dot on HuffPost, but keep going.
And the next one, CNBC, and that's the story about him throwing it in the trash. Trump's Syria letter made Erdogan so angry he threw it in the trash.
So that was on CNN?
That was CNBC. BBC's got the same headline, threw it in the trash. Okay.
Because you definitely got to circle back to CNN news this week.
Yeah. He's got... The Washington Examiner, though, took a line from the letter and said, and the headline, you know, on the click on the site says, Trump and letter to Erdogan, don't be a tough guy. Don't be stupid is the next line.
Yeah. I mean, the wording is just so, it reminded me of the hard boiled detective stories of the 50s. You know, it was just like, it was a rainy day and President Trump sent the cease and desist letter, you know? Boom, boom, boom in the letter. It's like, that's pretty matter of fact.
Yeah, there was nothing diplomatic about that letter at all. And you mentioned the things I've been listening. I have SiriusXM, and so I mainly listen to Underground Garage and a couple other channels. And so I just happened to get turned off, and it came back on. It turns out they now have a Radio Classic channel. So I've been listening to it. And it's sort of interesting because it's all those old radio shows going back into the 30s, 40s, and the 50s.
Oh, wow. Old school, early radio. Okay.
Yeah. And it's really entertaining to listen how they did all that. How, you know, because it was live. They're standing in front of a microphone. They got all these people doing sound effects and everything around them. And you go, probably got a little orchestra over there playing the music. And, you know, and what talented people they were.
Oh, it's incredible what they did in those little studios with that early technology. And it's just, you know, probably spent half the time in the control room putting out fires at that time, you know, where it just blew up again, you know, because that early stuff was a little finicky. But yeah, it's just amazing, the whole early days of radio.
Yeah. So I sit there and I'm having to travel quite a bit right now. And so I just listen to, I put that on. It makes the time go a little faster than just listening to music. But, it's listening to some of those old detective stuff and the writing, you know, which started, you know, came from the movies, doing the film noir.
Yeah. The whole film noir genre.
Yeah.
I love the Foley artists sitting there. It's like, how do you make the sound effect of a gun? Because if you fire a gun, it doesn't sound like a gun. You know, how do you make the sound effect of a horse, you know, or bones cracking and all this, like the celery tricks and stuff. It's just.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there's somebody there with a whole table of that stuff right in front of him. And he's got his little script and his cue, and he's trying to break it or snap it or blow it up or whatever on cue.
And just the production of that, you know, so the producer was out there actually producing, you know, it was like, okay, now you come in and you know, looking at the engineers the whole time to see, you know, what are the levels, right, you know, having to do all of that.
Well, that's what I was wondering, how they kept all, back then, you know, how they had the mixing boards and their, I don't know how they were doing that. I've I know a little bit about it, and I'm like, how in the world did they get all these microphones? And I don't know what they used as a mixer. I mean, I guess they had some sort of tube type thing. I guess they were able to plug into
early variable resistor. You know, basically up and down. You know, you know, and y'all all go into the same thing. There's like one mic in the room, and everybody has to go up and be the right distance from that mic, depending on what role they're playing, because you know, that's the only mic in the room, and it goes to just this one thing. Like you said, going out live, and then finally magnetic tape coming in to the point where you could then record the shows on magnetic tape. They weren't lost forever, you know.
So. Yeah, well, that's why this is. It's, you know, I think the earliest ones I've heard from in the 40s, early 40s, around, you know, at the end of World War II, and a lot of them in the 50s. But then you're listening to Bob Hope and George Burns, and you know, it's just like, wow, you know. It's sort of interesting. We're some of us are a little older, so we lived through that time. But I was thinking, let's see what you think about this. Okay, I don't know how old I'm 68. I don't know how old you are.
You're one bucket ahead of me, basically. I'll be 57 in November. So this is coming up to birthday month here at Trading Post.
Yeah, so. You're like Fetch's age.
Yeah, yes, Fetch and I are in the same lap. So laps around the sun.
Yep. Well, you know, I was thinking the other night about, you know, everything seems to go in a cycle, you know. And so I graduated in 1969. In fact, I was at my high school icebreaker reunion last night. And I was thinking, I said, you know, it's interesting. Look at the chaos we're in right now. And then it started 3 or 4 years ago, basically, when it really got bad, when it started. That's about the same time everything started getting kicked up in the 66, 67, 68, 69, with the Vietnam War.
Yeah, you had like the Vietnam War, you had the 7-Day War, the USS Liberty, the Summer of Love with the counter-revolution, you know, the counterculture. You know, so that was a pivotal year. And also, you started to see this real control of the media at that point.
Yes.
You know, you see all this consolidation of power of the media by a certain group, Echo, Echo, Echo. And... You know, so
yeah, I hear you. It is, and the other thing about it is that now we're going through the same thing, in a sense.
They're
almost on the same timeline.
Culture, another level, you know, and it's just exposing it left and right. I think, you know, the Jeffrey Epstein revelations, you know, woke a lot of people up on that. Yeah. Okay, so. Pat Rabbit is saying he graduated in 69 too, so you two are sharing the bucket level there, as we say in the Breakfast Club.
Is Pat Rabbit the is he the guy that lives down in Louisiana?
I'm not gonna say. He can call in and say, but
oh no, well I mean, he used to be, if that's the guy that was in the chat room, he and I used to chat a little bit when I used to go to their chat room. It wasn't under the name of Woody though. I was just curious. Yeah, he's a Mason. He's a he and I used to discuss that because that was like, you know, Fetch's big deal. You know,
well, that was one of the big conversations, you know, we had, was, you know, my background in masonry and everything. And we definitely have to circle back to the homecoming thing. We've got it because Appalachian State University here in Watauga County, North Kakalaki, is having homecoming weekend this weekend. And so I had a lot of observations while I was out on Crow Patrol yesterday in the county as everybody's preparing for the festivities. But anyway, shout out to the Revolution Radio crew. Appreciate everything that y'all do every time we guest host here. And, you know, just really appreciate everything. And, you know, I really still know what y'all are up against with the recent loss of Nighthawk and all. And we all miss him greatly. And I know everybody's trying to fill some big boots out there. But you know, I'm just so thankful y'all are able to keep the station going, and we're getting ready to go into the commercials. We talk about, you know, station support, but it is so important. And you know, we really appreciate all that y'all do out there. And you know, again, we really hate the loss of Nighthawk, and everybody stepping up to, you know, help we newbies out, you know, with getting our stuff on the air here. So I appreciate all the crew out there this morning taking good care of us.
Second that. Good. Yeah, so we got about 5 minutes, it looks like, for the break. I think it comes in at 27. I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah, Pat is kind of cueing me here. Yeah, so Pat is saying that he went through the York Rite too. That's one of the I went through the Blue Lodge and up to the York Rite, and that was a big thing that the Purity Spiralist got me for was in the Fetch interview. We were just trying to describe the level that I had gotten to, and I was trying to make the point that I was beyond just the first 3 degrees. Most people are familiar with the Scottish Rite of Albert Pike, which has its 32 degrees. In North Carolina, the rule is to be a Shriner, you have to be a 32nd degree equivalency. And that means that you need to go through the 32 degrees of the Scottish Rite, of which the Blue Lodge is the first 3 degrees, or you can go through the York Rite to be a Shriner. And so I just, you know, put that out like it had been explained to me. And, oh, man, you talk about stepping into a hornet's nest. Man, people tore me up over that. And I was out there trying to say, I was York Rite. You know, it's an equivalency thing. They're like, oh, you're just full of BS because, you know, that's not even a thing. You know, I'm like, oh, God, just kill me now.
You know, that's interesting. You explained something to me I didn't understand. My dad was a Scottish Rite, and in fact, it's in North Carolina. His main lodge was based in probably Wake Forest or Durham, because that was pretty much where he grew up.
Yeah,
that's where he started very early. But he told me that he was a Shriner, but he dropped out, and because I was always heard that you had to be a 30, I think it's a 33 now. You got to get to a 33 before they let you be a Shriner, to what I was told.
Oh, but, interesting, because it's like, okay, how do you define that? Because that's one of the most nebulous things in the Freemasonry model, is what defines a 33rd degree Mason.
Yeah, well, you could do it at 32, and that's what he was.
Yeah. And I really hated it because, you know, on the surface, you know, on the surface, the Shriners, you know, growing up, I was in Boy Scouts and all that, and all my Scout leaders were Freemasons and all, so you just, and the Shriners were always in the Christmas parades, et cetera. And so, you know, you hear about the hospitals, you know, the children's hospitals, and you realize that this is a lot more marketing than organic. You know, and but you know, we wanted to be in what was known as the Hillbilly Clan up here of the Shriners, and they're the ones that preserve all those real old early automobiles and trucks and jalopies, farm tractors of that were the first generation of that technology, and so that's what the Hillbilly Clan Shriners do. And that was what I was wanting to join, but I dropped out before I got that far.
Yeah, it was expensive too.
Well, that, yeah, to me, that's the big secret of Masonry, where Masonry's power is. Everybody's always trying to find this, you know, the hidden Luciferian code to unlock whatever. And it's like, you know, the obvious thing is, dude, just from a game theory perspective, the big secret of Masonry is you've got a bunch of useful idiots out here. No offense to my brethren, but yeah, just looking at it from game theory and who's behind it, you know, it's, you know, you're paying a huge amount of money in every month to be part of this syndicate. And, you know, how is that money being funneled? You know, and that is a huge chunk of change to be, you know, you've got to pay your Blue Lodge memberships and you got to pay whatever high ranking or apparel, you know, as he pointed out, Mr. Pat pointed out, you know, it's a horizontal leveling up after the first 3 degrees. So you don't really think of it, you know, Freemasons are big about being on the level, you know, stand on the levels, part on the square, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, you move up to that lodge, then the Shriners, you got another membership fee. And if you move up to the Jokers or whatever, you know, that's another thing. And you know, so it's this high dollar. And it's like, where is that money going? Because that in a zero sum game, you know, that's a huge chunk of force multipliers there. You
know? It's funny. Back in late 1990, somewhere in there, I was already involved in the esoterica before I met Fetch. But when I finally, when I found the Illuminati Observer, it's funny. I went in and I found it, and I'd already sort of broken a code, and so I was already sort of aware of the Pi thing. Because mm-hmm. I was seeing it, I didn't see it the way Dennis saw it. I broke it by just looking at graphics, and it was hidden in all these graphics. And no, everybody just poo-pooed me and tell me, you know, the usual. Oh man, you know what you're talking about? Just conspiracy theory, yada yada yada.
Yeah, put on your tinfoil hat.
Yeah, yeah. I said, well, I got a bunch of them. But the so I was reading a newspaper article, sitting at my desk, reading the newspaper. And there was a story about they had gone around and the Masons, evidently a lot of the Masons coming up, they were having trouble with membership. And I guess that's probably still going on. And a lot of the Masons told the reporter that they were disappointed because when they joined Masonry, because they'd always heard they had all these secrets and secret knowledge and all this stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. So they said, you know, we got in there, but we haven't seen it. We haven't seen any of this stuff. All they do is keep asking us for money.
Yeah. You know, schmuck.
And I was just laughing. I said, I wish I could. I said, man, what you need is out there. You don't even need the Masonry. If you'll just know where to go and pay attention, you'll start to see what this stuff was. I mean, even back then, everybody was looking at the number 33 showing up every time in the newspaper.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back that far. 33 injured, 33 found dead. And then you see, and then it's the retraction. And oh, it was 62. You know, we had to say 33 in the first one as the code word to probably let you know we were in charge of that.
Yeah, we're getting ready to go into a break, but you know, we need to swing back on that one and talk about when Captain Morgan wrote his book expose on Freemasonry, and you know, to show that there's, you know, there's no truth in this. There's a lot of novelty, a lot of cleverness, but there's no truth in this.
Before the break, I was in the pool with the guy, and he was a Blue Lodge member. There's a Blue Lodge not far from where I live down on the coast. And so I was in the pool and we were talking about this guy. And so I started talking to him about the pie stuff and, you know, in the alphabet. And he looked at me. He said, you know who Cap Morgan is? I said, yeah, I know exactly who Cap Morgan is. He says, you know what happened to him, don't you? You need to shut your mouth.
Shut your mouth. Yes.
Yeah. I know it now. I should have looked at him and go, Mahabone.
Oh, he said that, not me.
Yeah. Well, I've never taken the note.
Down, you know. It's like, gee, he said some funny phrase and all of a sudden the station went out again.
All I know is I've got a friend that it's a long story, but whether we're late on the break, I don't think they're doing the bottom of the hour breaks.
Well, I'm not getting cued from Mr. Pat's here. So
it's 9:30.
Yeah. I was kind of waiting for it to,
I heard somebody say a little, not too long ago, they did away with the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
But I guess we're finding out. I'll tell you another interesting thing. The school I went to in Memphis, with our reunion. So when they sent out the information, somebody got up a history of that high school and where it started and everything. And its original start, what's his name? What's the guy that started the lodge again?
About Albert Pike?
Albert Pike, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Albert Pike, you know, he was from the South, and he was in Arkansas, of course, a general. But he moved to Memphis, and he was an editor for the Commercial Appeal, which was the main newspaper still here, of the Commercial Appeal. And, you know, General Forrest was here and was in Memphis. So the high school was started originally in a building that shared the high school and the Scottish Rite shared the same building. And the original name of the school before they changed it to what it is now was Albert Pike High School.
Yeah, you know, he was a hero. And just an update here so we can keep going. Just got word from the studio, tip of the hat to the studio again, that we are not doing bottom of the hour breaks now on the show. And so we will just go to the top of the hour and then we'll take a break.
Okay. So, I thought that was funny. I mean, here it is. And I'm like, I'm going to Albert Pike High School in a sense. I said, how friggin' ironic is that?
Yeah, you know, it's destiny, a meaningful coincidence, a synchronicity. You know, I'm all about synchronicity and synergy, you know. It's like those meaningful coincidences.
And the guy in the pool, though, man, he was really upset. He said that he worked on some of that stuff. He'd go to the lodge, and he was working on it.
Uh-huh. You know?
But he got really upset. I mean, you know, and I do that with him. I mean, I got a master chief that lives behind me in the house down in Florida, and he's in the Blue Lodge too. And you know, and so they just like it's something we know that they don't, and they just don't understand it.
Right.
We know more about some of the stuff that they do than they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of been drilled out of that, I guess. I know I've talked to Pat, and he knows from our conversations in the chat room from years ago. He knows a little bit about what we're talking about, like the numbers and meetings and that. It's different in the Scottish Rite from what he thinks and then what we think. Because you know we're going back with Dennis to a different form of masonry, because Scottish Rite didn't even start till the 65, 66, something like that, when he started to pull it all together.
Oh, yeah, that was a really late development in Masonic history. You know, especially just considering, you know, when the 1717 Grand Lodge of London, that's kind of like a benchmark, and, you know, he was just so far after that. So it's amazing how much masonry morphed in just a few years there.
Oh, they took it away. I mean, they all the other lodges, and I've talked with Dennis about this a little bit, and he has some sources, and he said that one of the sources told him that they had planned to shut those lodges down. That was one of the goals, was to run that out, which is really weird. And that's a brother for you, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
And but they and they started it, and they all were shut down, and the year is really weird. The year 1947, whatever the year for Roswell was.
Okay, that sounds about let me see here. Pull up my timeline, you know, my trusty timeline, which I should have had up already. Here we go.
Yeah, you got that nice timeline.
Yeah, Breakfast Club's all about the timelines. Big T, little T.
But, you know, it's it it's changed, and most people aren't even aware of that. And it's like they don't understand that there's the Blue Lodge, there's the Scottish Rite. And I asked the guy, the Master Chief, he's also a corpsman in the Marines. I asked him something. I said, well, what do you guys, because, you know, they didn't go. They all just stayed down at the Blue Lodge with their 3 degrees. And they didn't want to go to Scottish Rite. And I asked him why. And I could tell he didn't want to answer. But finally, I sort of pressed him a little bit. And he said, well, they're just a little squirrely.
Oh, that's a euphemism. Yeah. Squirrely.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, what's it? Yeah.
Verify fun facts here. July 1947, Roswell, New Mexico. So, yep, you nailed it.
Yeah. Wish I'm not having those senior moments too often now. but it's, yeah, it was something about it. You know, we're looking at the timeline when it just really took off after that of trying to shut them down. It's just strange how it messed with, you know, that it coincided, you know, with that year and that event.
Mm-hmm.
Which is most of us, we don't go into it because we have probably our own personal views, but it's one of those things that, you know, until I have absolute proof, but I'll tell you the only one thing that I have is that I don't understand, and it's in there, is people ask me about 9/11. Well, what about 9/11? What did they do? How did they do it? And I said, you know, I can't tell you because it doesn't make any sense, because things that happened that day just should not have happened.
They violate the laws of physics day. Everybody knows that. You're not.
Yeah. Violate physics day. and I knew it that morning watching. I mean, I knew it for, I have a background in film, high-end film and stuff like that. So I was watching it, and I noticed something about all the cameras that they were using that morning. And then, you know, I happened to just wake up. I couldn't sleep that night. I mean, I was tossing and turning all night. And finally I said, okay, maybe I'll get up, you know, and I'll just watch some TV and I can go back to sleep and watch. So I came in the room, turned on my big square 36-inch Sony TV back then, you know, big monster, and was sitting there watching it and turned it on. I sat down in my chair and I watched maybe 2 minutes, and then I saw the second plane hit that building. And I went, what the hell? And then I started watching closer and I said, something's not right. And all the stuff that you sort of see in what's his name, Simon Shack stuff, where he has all that stuff with the helicopters. He's been working on it for years and keeps adding to it. All the anomalies with the cameras and the shifting and all this stuff. I was seeing that that morning. So I didn't believe, I was already suspicious right then. But this is what I tell people, and they say, well, what was 9/11? And my answer is it was a demonstration.
Ah, very good. Because it was
what we can fucking do. Sorry.
That was just that, you know, this is a coup d'etat to seize power. You know, and this is a show of strength, because not only are they pulling this off, but they are covering it up and getting away with it. You know, and this is the new rules now. And it's just that problem, reaction, solution. And you know, I was one of those people that, you know, I have an engineering background, you know, and granted I'm in communication, or was in communications engineering. But you know, you still had to take all the same physics class, the same math classes, the same statics and dynamics classes, the same thermodynamics classes, the same chemistry classes as those, you know, engineers who build buildings and architects, et cetera. So the mathematics of Newtonian physics is across the board. And any high school student who's taken a, you know, high school level physics class should have looked at 9/11 and said, oh, hell no, which is what I did, you know, And then, you know, to me, the topper, the confirmation red flag was when they started trying to sell the cell phone calls and, you know, the air phone calls and all of this, you know, the phone calls of 9/11, as they came to be called. And, you know, I was just like, oh, double hell no on that one, because at the time, you know, I was, you know, on the bleeding edge of the technology of migrating second generation communications, telephone and computer networks separate forever, to the third generation, you know, with this convergence. And it's like, you know, how are cell phones going to work in this new third generation network, right? And so it's just like they're trying to sell me this idea of the heroes of 9/11 on their cell phones at this, you know, they're at this airspeed, this altitude, and I can't even stand in front of the tower and get a signal, you know, much less have a call.
A plane going 300 for 5 minutes,
you know, over this many different towers. And it's like, no, the handoff technology is not there at the time. I'm sorry, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah,
you know, just like, and but then I would get to my classes, and it was, you know, Zombieville. This was like something out of, you know, the what is it, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where everyone is in such cognitive dissonance that you can't talk about this being physically impossible. And I'm sitting there, you know, training everybody from NSA, CIA, FBI, you know, military intelligence, naval intelligence, and Motorola, you know, MITRE, all these places, you know, Booz Allen Hamilton. And it's like, if anybody in the world should be calling BS on this, it is all of you. But I'm hearing a deafening silence. And next thing you know, I'm living out of my car in a tent. So it's like, oh, we have had a coup d'etat. Okay. So I always tell people I got sucker punched on 9/11 and bitch slapped. Excuse my French. But,
well, you know, everybody did. I mean, it
yeah.
My career, like yours, it wasn't because of that, but just back then I was pretty much working in Los Angeles. And after that happened, man, the industry sort of, it changed, and there wasn't really anything being shot out there anymore. Everything moved to Canada. We weren't allowed to, the Canadian Union would not let us go up there and work on their features. And almost everything now is shot in Canada. You look at, I mean, you know, Toronto's New York, you know? So, but I will tell you though, real quick, let's see, with 43, I really didn't know. I mean, I wasn't sure what had happened. And you know who Judy Wood is, of course.
Oh, yes.
And so I was writing at Reb sites about it and actually, you know, trying to fight the cover up people. And because they were everywhere. They had, boy, when you talk about trolls coming out and starting the websites and being flooded with the websites. Right after that, they started hitting the boards really good, trying to counter everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was writing, and then Judy Wood came onto a site and contacted me and gave me her phone number. And I didn't really believe Judy at that time. My words were to her were, I thought you were batshit crazy. And I mean, and so we called and talked. Now, this goes back to when Judy had just really started going. Her site was hosted on tripods. She didn't even have her own, you know, website, so to speak. And it was just jumbled. And so I called her up, and it was like we must have talked for 4 hours on the phone. And she was explaining to me everything that she had found up to that point. And when that phone call was over, I don't care what you think about Judy Wood. What I do know is that the evidence that she's uncovered, that's photographic evidence, and all the other evidence she has, if you look at that, and can, you know, the basement is still there underneath those buildings. She's got photographs where that she's looking, you know, up from cameras up top or somewhere on buildings, but they're shooting down into the rubble. And there was a Disney store underneath one of the buildings, one or two, I'm not sure. And you can still see the characters from the in the store, the big, you know, like mannequins of Roadrunner and Bugs Bunny and, you know, and all the merchandise and everything. It's there. It didn't – listen, if that much rubble had fallen through, it would have gone all the way through. And that building is built in what she terms it the bathtub, because what it is, it's more like a swimming pool. It's on an island, so there's seawater there. So they had to build a big concrete bottom, and then they built up a wall, and that became the basement and the foundation. Well, if that building had fallen through there, it would have cracked that thing, and it would have flooded Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't. Nothing went through down the bottom, and all that's, and a lot of the stuff was Photoshopped. But she has photos, and then she kept gathering them. She got some satellite stuff. And over the years, I stayed in communications with her for a while, but no longer do. But she, she has some really just straight up make no sense evidence. How can you claim this much material fell straight down? And where is it? That's the other part. Where is it?
Where is it? Exactly. You know, it was dust and just pulverized. You know, this was not, you know, a fall over collapse. And have you heard about the recent Alaska University study, University of Alaska at Fairbanks?
I have.
Study? You have or you have not?
I have.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, so here, yeah, that should have been the biggest story in the news cycle. You know, where was CNN when that story broke? That, you know, architects and engineers and these engineers at this, you know, U.S. university concluded this had to be a demolition. You know, the official story, the official collapse is physically impossible. That's my big thing, is what they presented is physically impossible. We may never know all the nuances of exactly how they did it, but we've got enough to know who had the motive, who had the means, who had the opportunity, who benefited. And the body of evidence that we have, rock solid, is enough that we should be able to get a warrant for mass arrest from any real judge in this republic. But we are under such a power thumb that due process is not happening. You know, and the media uniformly, nobody in the U.S. covered that story except for the new media. You know, it was all over the blogosphere of the new media. But, you know, complete shutdown in the fake news enemy of the people, Mockingbird media, echo, echo, echo. So it's like, who benefits from that? You know, who benefits by not running with this story? People like Jeff Zucker, echo, echo, echo at CNN.
yeah, it's, you know, I Judy's got her own theory, and she's changed it over time now. It's not exactly what it was. She's looking at more photographs. That dust was so fine. She has photographs where people are walking through that dust and the street. It was so fine. Now, and you have to see the photographs, and they're not Photoshopped. As they're walking, that dust is so fine. Just their footsteps and prints is lifting up that dust, and it comes up around their ankles and up to maybe mid-calf.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you go find me a product off the shelf or anywhere that's that fine. Somebody did the micron measurement on it, and it's barely there.
And, you know, the same thing with architects and engineers. There was this, you know, real early on, a chemist professor actually did the study to show that there were iron microspheres in this dust. And for that to happen, you had to get at these temperatures that were far beyond anything that an office fire or, you know, any type of regular fire, jet fuel fire, could possibly make. It was physically impossible. Yet these microspheres are there, like you said, in this almost, you know, the texture is just so fine. And I guess, yeah, that's why it also became so lethal to all those first responders out there that are now dead or dying horribly, because the same people, you know, that controlled the crime scene. Also, we were controlling FEMA and EPA, and they told them to go out in there and work because the air was fine and safe. And it's like, dead men tell no tales. You know, we're going to kill all the eyewitnesses here. And, you know, this is insanity that they weren't, those men weren't, or women weren't provided with the proper gear for that toxic of an environment. But yeah, she was spot on when she was saying, yeah, look at this. This just doesn't happen from an office fire.
Well, I don't, you know, people try to say that, a lot of people are stuck on thermite. Maybe there were some in there. I don't know, but it couldn't have been what took that whole building down and done that. That's impossible.
Right.
And so, they keep going and they say, well, it was thermite. And I'm saying, if it was thermite and it did that across that whole wall or around the building, where was the flash? Cause it didn't flash. There was no flash. You had a couple of windows with something and that was about it. And, in fact, her and I talked about that. I was doing some work with her and trying to determine if it was photoshopped or not. Mm-hmm. And it just couldn't have been I don't buy that. It was something we've never seen before. And she believes that. And Judy Wood was working at the University of Alabama when this happened, and she was in the cafeteria and it was up on the screen. You know, and she said she was sitting there and she watched it and she was like, us, that can't happen. That's not.
Normal. Yeah, that can't happen on this planet. I'm sorry. You
know, yeah.
That to happen, you have to go to some other altered, you know, game rule universe. But on this planet, that physically can't happen. That, you know, so we're going to say it's Defy the Laws of Physics Day.
Well, she stayed on it, and the university warned her to get off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even in her private stuff, and she wouldn't do it. So they got rid of her, and she was like, I can't, it was a physics having to do with real high level optics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was what her major was and her teaching and her specialty. And so she ended up couldn't get hired anywhere. And the last I heard, she was up in the Northwest somewhere and she was working as a elementary school teacher. And that's about what she could do. And to this day, I hear she's still sort of working on it a little bit at the time, but and people say, well, she's saying, and they tag her. So the discreditor, a Moonbeam Judy, a space alien Judy, she's never, ever said anything like that. She's always very scientific and professional. That.
And, you know, I always go back to the idea that our adversary is playing the long game, you know, that they have been at this for a very long time. And I go back to science fiction writers like H.G. Wells. And when he was describing in War of the Worlds, the weapons used against the humans was, you know, the directed energy weapon, the heat ray. That would just vaporize anything that was unlike any of the weapons of Victorian England when he was writing this. You know, these weapons of wars are going to be so far beyond what we have, and they're going to be completely diabolical, completely heartless of a species that is completely alien to you and just sees you as cattle. You know, that, you know, they were here to colonize Earth. They weren't here to, you know, assimilate and become part of the British Empire. They were here to conquer. And also the black smoke, you know, that poison smoke. And then you look at, you know, the history timeline of the science of laser technology and maser technology, you know, focused microwave energy. And then you look at just what we have on the shelf now. Go out and read, you know, Jane's, you know, military, you know, Jane's magazine, which talks about all the new product lines coming out from the, you know, death complex, you know, the war industry. And it's like, okay, you have this kind of technology now, yeah, that you, you know, the idea of a directed energy weapon is a thing, just like an EMP weapon now is a thing. So we got about 1 minute until the break. So you want to bring us up to the break?
Okay, I'm looking. Let me know when he comes in. I think it's a couple of minutes away.
We go to 56. So
56. Okay.
Yeah, gosh, almost quite there. At 56.
Okay. All right. I got my computer set to the correct time. And people say she's Jewish. I don't know anything about that. She never seemed, you know. I left Judy when she started getting involved with a guy from Canada that claimed that he had developed free energy, basically, or a ability to do something, and had these films he used. And I looked at all of those, these don't demonstrate that. I mean, you cut the, you're not. I can't get anything out of these films. I can't say this is real because.
Listen, you're saying radio, freedom slips.
Unless I was standing there and saw it happen, right? The way he set the cameras up, the angles, and all this stuff. I'm not going to say that this is correct. And a lot of people backed off of her when she got involved with him.
All right, we are on break. I'm sorry to cut you off. We'll pick this up on the other side. Okay, I think we're back. You're listening to Inside the Eye Live with Mr. Dennis Fetcho. I'm your guest co-host, Frederick C. Blackburn, a.k.a. Blackbird 9. And co-hosting with me today is Mr. Woody. So we made it to the second hour.
Two to go.
Professional.
Yeah.
Don't try
caught
this.
Caught us by surprise, he did. Caught us by surprise. So, you know, 9/11, you know, it's old news, but it's really not, you know. And the thing is you talked about that study from Alaska, and immediately after that, I was just sort of Googling around with it, trying to get some more info. And already they'd put out the trolls, they'd sent out the trolls, claiming how this guy didn't know what he was doing, didn't run the investigation correctly. This is a bunch of hooey and all that stuff. And I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah, and then I think the big one, I always say 9/11 is the litmus test. You know, I asked somebody, you know, 9/11, believe it, the official story or other. You know, I'm not really care what your other is, the nuances of your other, but do you believe the official story or not? You know, more and more people are waking up to that, you know, that we were had. So a lot of people say, well, that was almost two decades. That's what kills me. It's like we're almost two decades from 9/11, and people still aren't waking up to the fact that they were being fooled. And it's like, you know, Mark Twain always said it's easier to fool someone than convince them they've been fooled. And so this idea of that people trusting the compromised media of this big physically impossible lie over their neighbor like me. You know, I'm just tinfoil hat loony boon, you know, here. I question, you know, what the television said. Yeah, because they are experts, you know. Who are you? It's like, well, I used to be an expert, I guess, you know, but not anymore.
You see, that's the claim, you know, in the Carl Sagan's 10 baloney rules is claiming that you're an authority because you're an expert.
Yes.
There are no experts. No such thing. You know, it's a generalization term in a way. But there is no way you could be an expert on that day because you can't explain it. You cannot explain it. I don't care what you say. You violate it. I'm free fall. I'm sorry. That's and disappearing.
Yeah.
But the other part of that is too, is it's not just that the pilots for truth have clearly looked at this. And the head of that organization is a FedEx pilot. And if you go read their conclusions and stuff, and they went out and went to the flight, where it was coming over, supposedly the one that hit the Pentagon.
Yeah, the big corkscrew that everybody who's actually flown a plane says, not with that plane at that altitude ever. I mean, it's just it's impossible to do that maneuver with that plane. You know, not even on a good day with the best pilot can that maneuver be done.
And it's just not that.
Yeah.
They finally got the radar logs, and they traced them, and they went out to where they would have to fly over, and they actually talked to people that were in like this service station or whatever it was that day. And the logs showed it took this path over the station. And everyone that was at that station says, oh, no, it was way over here. So whatever flew over us, and they would say, and then it went down, and it went like toward the Pentagon, and then it pulled up and peeled away.
Well, you know, it's like Harley Davidson guy, you know, one of my favorite crisis actors when we were really understanding political theater, Trotsky political theater with crisis actors and bad player media, where these people are given a script to be an eyewitness and they're out there out of work actor trying to, you know, make it big by doing whatever job, pay for play jobs they can get from George Soros. And yeah, they're out there giving this eyewitness testimony that's physically impossible. And then they just disappear, you know, like Harley Davidson. Then you see him pop up in all these other crisis manipulations. And it's like, he's my favorite crisis actor. You know, who is this guy? And you go, do they actually have an IMDb page? You know, it's like Greta Thunberg. I have my own actor page.
How dare you?
You have stolen my dreams. Damn you all.
Die. How dare you? You ruined my childhood. Bend over. Let me get the belt.
Really? Also, the studio shuts us down. Y'all being too silly in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just the physical impossibility. But these people are out there selling it. This is what, yeah, Edward Bernays' marketing is all about, is sell it. You know, yes. There is no objective truth. We're from the Frankfurt School. You know, truth is totally subjective. Yeah.
And the other thing about that jet coming in and hitting that building at that altitude, well, which is just feet off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a pilot, but I know, but I've been in some airplanes and I've sort of gotten some instruction. And I know a few things about them. And there's this thing called ground effects.
Yes.
And so bringing that jet in and trying to be that low and keep it and hitting the ground, the ground effects is trying to make that plane lift.
Yeah.
So a pilot of this guy's skill would not have been able to pull off that maneuver. There's just no way.
Yeah, and then this idea of those, even if it, you know, even if it, you know, you get your whole thought experiment here and you allow all these impossible variables that, okay, even if you had this condition violated, but this condition violated, and then it still managed to get to here, it's not going to make this cookie cutter imprint on the building like, you know, the Acme, you know, Warner Brothers car Coyote going into the wall and has this perfect outline. You know, like, that's not how it's going to happen. You know, but
you know, and you know, there's audio from long ago, and Trump's talking about this. You know, Trump's wise to it. He knows.
Oh, yeah. I love that early interview where he's like, you know, this is what happened. And then,
well, you know, and it's how it was built. And that's the other thing. You know, it was built to take, I think, it was either 5 or 7 hits from planes that size, and it should have stayed up. It was built, described sort of like a spider's web. Everything wasn't totally connected to everything. And that's the other part. And the guy that designed that building, I think the plane came in and took him out in his office. He was in his office.
Oh, that's all the convenient deaths of 9/11, like the FBI special agent, John O'Neill, who died on his first day working with was it Kroll Associates Security under Jerome Hauer, Echo, 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 who just happened to be in the CNN studios explaining the entire official story. He was like, you know, Mr. Clouseau explaining who done it in the final parlor scene on CNN, right? And it's like, it was Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, you know, flying in airplanes in, and the buildings haven't even collapsed yet. And meanwhile, you've got Ehud Barak over here, you know, Jeff Epstein's buddy, but Ehud Barak on the BBC giving the exact same whodunit. And that became the official story of the 9/11 commission that didn't even, you know, include Building 7, you know, that was headed up by Philip Zelikow. Echo, echo, echo.
It changed this country. I mean, and this Syria pullout, everything that we're looking today that he's finally pulling it out and, you know, is a direct result of these same people after 9/11, where we went into Iraq, which is just, I mean, Afghanistan and then Iraq. I mean, it just, and none of it made sense. And they just pushed it down everybody's throats. And then they refused to leave. And I was really disappointed. They had a vote in the House where they, the House and the Senate, where they were like, you know, saying we don't approve of pulling these troops out of Turkey. 79 Republicans joined in with them. And some of those same Republicans are also some of the same ones that are coming on the news every day yelling about this thing going on with Trump right now and the impeachment thing and how crazy it is. But they all wanted to vote to show their displeasure. Because why? Because they're all tied into the, you know, what we used to just call the military industrial complex. It's all about money. It follow the Benjamins, and it's so true. And these guys, you know, are standing up going, oh, no, we want to keep these troops over there. We want to keep spending money and battles, and we need more bombs. And
yeah, and then you just go back to the this was a crime. This was the crime of the century. You know, this was a very well-crafted, thought-out crime that had multiple players, you know.
Well, and I will say it was thought out. I would not say it was well crafted because it's been seen through. So obviously they made, you talked about people calling in. All right. You go back and listen to the phone calls that happened that morning. And all these people were calling in, giving eyewitness stuff about what they saw. They happen to be, most of them, the wives of the people that worked at the networks.
Exactly. You know, always look at the spouses. You know, that's one of the game rules. It's like, okay, they're presenting themselves as a white hat player, but they are married to this person who's part of this. It's kind of like the Cass Sunstein power. You know, as was her name, Samantha. Now, is it Samantha Power? At the UN selling this at the same time. And he would go on to write the book about cognitive infiltration of the 9/11 truth movement, how, you know, this, you know, new media is exposing, you know, everything. We have to shut it down. You know, you got to shut it down. And so he's talking about how to infiltrate all of these truth movements and tear them apart using psychological warfare tactics, right? And this is one of Obama's guys, right? President Obama. And, you know, it's like, okay, you know, so this guy is trying to just, you know, dismantle the truth movement. You know, why does he have a position of power? And exactly what is his wife doing at the UN again? And she's in with Susan Rice and that whole cabal. It's like, am I seeing a conflict of interest here?
I've got a website guy that I follow. It used to have, he's sort of famous. He's in a sense, it was a financial stock site. And I met him. And, but at his site, you cannot bring up, not if you bring up 9/11 and you bring up anything close to what we're talking about, he instantly bans you.
Oh yeah.
And then he will tell you, and he just did it the other day to somebody that said, hey, what his name is. He said, have you seen the new thing about Building 7 from Alaska, yada, yada, yada? And he banned him over that. His story is it happened the way that they said. Now, I happen to have had some communication with this person, and you'll probably understand this. He was the type of guy that when he had to go pee, he had to take his hard drive, go through 3 locked doors, and go to a safe and put it in the safe, and then he could leave and go to the bathroom, and then he had to come back and get his hard drive out again.
Okay.
So that's sort of his past, he told me. We talked about a couple of things. And so I know that he must have obviously worked in some capacity for something. Right. So he will not allow it at all. And then he claims it happened the way, and anybody that says different, yada, yada, yada. And it's just like, boy, why do you do this? Because I know you are brilliant. I mean, he talks nuclear weapons, you know, and how they're developed and everything. And I'm like, and he obviously knows something about it. He's a genius. He's a certified genius. And I'm like, what is your game? Why do you do this? Because your website, mainly, he doesn't do the financial. It's just he just uses it to post his comments and his thoughts. And I've still got a lot of followers. And I'm like, when you look at it at that level, that you got people there, they're so, I mean, it must be something that he better not say a word or let anything out and even look like he's tied into that. And he dismisses it. I've met people online that told me that they were one of the first responders that showed up there and said, oh, you're crazy. There were beams, there's poles, there are all this stuff. You know, you're wrong. You can't see it. And I'm going, I'm looking at a photograph. It's not there.
Mm-hmm.
What are you talking about? Why are you lying? You know, you couldn't have been there and seen this because here's a photograph taken from satellite. It's not there. You know, and they came in immediately. And this is, you know, all the big pictures where it showed that big pile of debris, you know, along the streets and everything.
Right.
When the buildings fell. Well, they brought in heavy equipment. And what was left, they stopped at around the 20th floor and left those few little beams and everything sticking up. So it looked like there was part of a building left there. And there were still a bunch of debris and everything that, you know, that still hit the ground. But they brought in heavy moving equipment and pushed it toward those angles and built up a big wall. So when you're walking by, you couldn't see into where it landed. You follow me? If you were on the street level, you weren't able to see that there was nothing there. They took what was left and they pushed it up. And then they came in that night. And we're bringing in tons and tons of dirt to that site at night.
Mm-hmm.
And they went in full, but when they came out, they were loading them up with debris. Because that's what they were supposedly coming for, was to take debris out. Right. So they were bringing in dirt, and then they put the debris on there. So what do you use dirt for? If there's something that happens and dirt's used to cover up spills, chemical spills, all types of spills. So they already had it planned to get all this dirt. I mean, you just don't, you know, get a bunch of dump trucks ordered up and lined up and get a place where they can go fill up with dirt in just a few hours. Because this happened immediately that night after.
Well,
after
also, you know, just the fact that you're contaminating a crime scene, and it reminds me of what the feds did at Waco with to destroy all evidence, bringing in all that dirt and, you know, scraping out everything that was there and bringing in another layer of dirt that, you know, you're never going to be able to do a legitimate chemical analysis now because we have tampered with the crime scene. We have destroyed the crime scene. And, you know, the stuff that didn't get pulverized was immediately shipped to China and incinerated. So what?
No, there's no bills of lading or anything for that stuff being
shipped. Oh, really? You're throwing a flag on that one, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, that it disappeared. I mean, it never hit the ground. Most of it never hit the ground. Mm-hmm. People have looked into it. I'm only taking their word for that. But I see it a lot of places, and nobody's debunked it. It's just what they said they were going to do, and they made up that whole story.
Oh, so that's just disinformation, you think?
Right. That's what it appears to be, disinformation, to make the add on to it that all the steel's not there because we shipped it to China.
Uh-huh.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, like we were saying at the first hour, you know, one of the things about this that's so maddening is, as a scientist, you rely on firsthand information. You know, you have, you know, what we call experiential information, where you were there, you saw it with your own eyes, and then you have secondhand information. And unfortunately, you know, for the most of us, all we have is secondhand information. And so it's, you know, how do you sort through those data nuggets? And at the Trading Post or the Breakfast Club, we talk about three types of information, where you have information, you have misinformation, and disinformation. So, you know, your information, of course, is stuff that has been verified, is factual, you know, but you know, you can accept as if true. Misinformation, where it's not quite 100% accurate, or it's not true, but not intentional. Just pass, you know, it's like telephone, you're passing on bad information that got relayed. But then you have deliberate lying, disinformation, you know, and you know, things that are intentionally lies. And then also you just had that lying by omission, that, you know, so much of this just is not talked about. You were talking about it earlier. It's like, you talk about this at your pay grade, you know, we will fire you. You know, we will destroy you. Are we making ourselves clear here? Because if you're working for that system and you go against that system, they think they have the right to, you know, fire you or destroy you or kill you, you know,
or put you under some intense COINTEL operations just to mess with your mind. I know that for a fact.
Well, these guys play to win. You know, this is, and they have no morality. That's that interesting thing about that, you know, a peculiar system of morality veiled in symbol and allegory or some such. You know, I have described this system of the New World Order, and you look at things like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and how you know, science fiction writers always describe their dystopias. That's one of the things I noted about, you know, science fiction writers, especially in the 50s. Is they never have a story where the Republic of the United States survives. You know, that this type of government system survives. It's always some post-apocalyptic, horrible, you know, world that they've dreamed up. But it has that same seven-layer model to it. You know, have you ever noticed that about science fiction, modern science fiction writers?
I've read so much science fiction in my life until about maybe right around the time 9/11 happened. I sort of dropped it.
Yeah, I don't think I've read a, you know, sci-fi novel since 9/11. It's like, I've got enough bizarre. You know?
Yeah. It's 9/11, you know, and then the numerology of it all. I mean, it's just so in your face, and everything that happened that day, and people, when you try to talk to them about it, it is like they've been pre-programmed. They just want to tune you out. They don't even want to go down that. Oh, I'm not into conspiracy theories. I'm saying this isn't a theory. This is fact. You need to understand the difference. And they just don't want to do it. They just do not want to disturb their world.
Their worldview. And that's what that whole cognitive dissonance is about. You know, you can't have more than one worldview. And if data points challenge that worldview, you will reject the data points. And you know, when you get into things like Solomon Asch's group conformity experiments and Stanley Milgram's authority experiments, yeah, they've got that down to a science as to how to manipulate people to, you know, think a certain way. And they know by game theory that a certain percentage, based on their intellect and education level, will believe their story versus the alternative. And then they demonize people like me with every, you know, name you can think of. You know, coming home, I realize, according to the majority of these carpetbaggers that have taken over my county, that I am a white supremacist hater, Nazi, bigot. It's like I used to just be a long-haired country boy up here in these mountains, but now I'm just Hitler. You know?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the projection, and I'm wondering how much of this is just so pre-planned that it came out of Tavistock. Because they're the master planners, the way I see it. That Tavistock, you know, was planning all this and how the media was going to be put out and how it was going to be arranged and everything that was going to happen after that. And nobody, you just do not, it's like, you just don't see that name mentioned anymore. It used to be at most of the sites and the boards where you were able to discuss all this, they were number one for a lot of time on issues of what was going on and where it's originating from. And you don't hear mention, you don't hear Tavistock talked about at all anymore.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you always kind of look at the Frankfurt School and then Tavistock and then Columbia University and you know, that transition there, and then how everything kind of went to the West Coast Silicon Valley. And so you just see this thread of these thought leaders of this globo-homo agenda that's you know, basically there to overthrow all nations and establish their new world order model, you know, that you just see this long game progression that, you know, they move from here to here to here to here. And each time they, you know, advance their cause.
Yes. Which brings us back. And part of that is that where I live, I can, for half the time or on and off, there's a elementary and a junior high school from where I live. Like, just a couple of blocks. And so the kids are walking home by me all the time and going down the street headed their way coming from the school. And I started noticing, you know, probably going back 4 or 5 years ago. And since then, it's gotten even worse. But not one of them ever are walking without their face in that telephone or in their cell phone or what their computer. Really, it's just amazing. And they're walking along and they're looking at it and they're intently staring at it and you know, not even knowing what's going on around them. And I was in the grocery store the other day and there were like three kids in front of me, different ages, like from 10 up to maybe 18 with their mom. And every one of them, while mom's getting her groceries, are standing behind her in line and they're all into the cell phone. And so I started watching the young kid that was probably maybe he was 12, maybe 10, 12, couldn't really tell. The older you get, it gets harder to tell. And so he was looking, so I was watching what he was looking at on his screen. And you know what it turned out? I mean, I watched him. He was just looking at it. He wasn't even really communicating with anybody. He would pull it down. It was like a chat thing with a bunch of symbols for their people and little something, you know, maybe a statement out to it. He'd just be looking at it. Then he'd click on it and it'd go to that page. And then he'd just immediately click it back. And then he'd just sit there and he'd scroll it up and then he'd scroll it down. And he'd scroll it up and he'd scroll it down. I'm like, he is so ingrained with that phone. He is waiting for some more stimulation to hit him. And even though there's nothing coming through on those pages that he's looking at, he is intently waiting for that next stimulation to hit him.
Exactly. Yeah. That, like, these lab rats that they people like John C. Lilly, Echo, 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 they would wire in, you know, electrical stimulation to the parts of the pleasure centers of the brain, and the mice would just sit there and hit the lever to get that pleasure receptor fix, and it's the same stimulus as somebody getting acknowledged on social media. You get this little adrenaline rush, opioid rush, and then are you, you know, was it positive or negative? Have you been put into fight or flight because somebody just trolled you and triggered you? And so you have all this, you know, biochemical, electrical things happening that are being triggered by the stimulus or stimuli of social media. And I always go back to both what George Orwell talked about in Brave New World, excuse me, in 1984, about everybody just being buried in their screens. And also you're talking about, you know, we were talking earlier about the counterculture of the 60s. And I thought about the last Monkees. People in my bucket level always remember the Monkees. You know, the Monkees were, you know, pop synthetic band from get-go. You know, they were a packaged band to be used to target not only the teenagers, but also the tweens. You know, this was being shown on, you know, Saturday morning cartoon time, aimed at that tween generation back in 67. And the last episode of the Monkees, Trivia Time, was called The Frotus Caper. And it was all about the television set sending out these signals that would hypnotize you and put you in a catatonic state. And that was what happened to Peter Tork, you know, that he was put in the catatonic state and everybody trying to save him from the And, you know, you go back and you watch that episode now, and it's like, talk about a Simpsons foreshadowing events. This was, you know, definitely predictive programming. This is what's going on in Hollywood.
Yeah, it. Like, well, it's, we all, you know, they always say, you know, somehow they have to warn us about what they're going to do. I mean, that's, and it, you know, you hear that, and when you look back on everything, you go, you know, you can always connect dot to dots if you want to, you know, but when you want to do three or four, it seems like that, yeah, you, it seems to be pretty obvious. And like Oleg Domagard's work, which some of it I don't agree with, but, you know, he's got to where he's trying to predict it from the video evidence and everything from the last false flag to where the next one's going to be. And he's actually hit it two or three times. Not all hits, but he's actually picked the next location from stuff that he saw in the video. Some of the stuff I disagree with him on is some of it's correct. The staging of the trucks, because I was in that industry, and how they're using the actors and how the trucks are arranged and everything. It's just like on a movie film. They're doing it. In fact, most of those people probably are in the industry, going down to your grips and your electricians and your and other people and your set designers and everything like that. And people always ask me, what about people putting all these symbols and everything in it? And I say, when I was on them, I was so busy, I wouldn't have known it if I was doing it. Right. I mean, and most of that stuff is added post, or it's in the set designer, which is a whole different thing. And she's coming in, or he is coming in and placing the objects or stuff. So that's where it really happens. If it's happening in the industry, it's happening with the people that are in charge of not building the sets, but decorating the sets.
Yeah. Your set designers, your screenwriters, you know, your directors, your producers, you know, who's putting up the money for the project and what is their worldview? What is their agenda? And so that's like, you know, here you have the organic part. We're just doing a fun story, right? This is just entertainment. And then you have the poison in there. And this is what we want to add in to push our agenda. And then we're going to sell that to our target audience, you know, our victims, you know, our targets, whatever you want to call them. And then we're going to monitor it with, you know, our sales receipts, you know, on our product placement, how is, you know, all this market research, the Nielsen ratings, you know, just all of these metrics that these guys have been using from day one. You know, some of the first computer applications were on market analysis for media. You know, the whole Nielsen ratings. We did a show a couple of weeks ago on artificial intelligence, you know, the development of artificial intelligence and fifth generation warfare. And it's like, you just kept going back to, and then in the entertainment industry, and then in the entertainment industry. You know, so that definitely you see these players that are there. And, you know, my question is, how many of them are connected to Talpiot, Israeli Talpiot and Unit 8200 groups? Yeah, that's my big tracking down, you know, sniffing out data dots now is who are these players over here doing this kind of set design, like you're saying, and are they connected to, you know, these groups over in Israel? And, you know, are they full-blown communists working for, you know, the overthrow of this republic to put in their new world order? You know, who are these people?
I from working out there, I mean it is obviously Jewish controlled for most part. I mean, that's who the big name players are and where a lot of the money comes from. And I had an experience on just one film that sort of threw me off a little bit. And I was like, what the heck? Why are we doing this? And I'm not going to name the movie, but we had a scene in the movie where there's a really attractive young woman, 17, 18, 19, something. You don't really know her age. But she lives at home with her dad. And she meets this bad guy. And they have, you know, the sort of a Bonnie and Clyde sort of thing starts to happen. But they had we shot a scene, so I was sort of in charge of lighting a lot of it. And that wasn't director of photography, but when you have certain positions, they just tell you what to do and you go do it and set it up. And then they come tweak it. So we were shooting a scene. It was real dark and I didn't really know what was coming. They must have added the pages into the script and I didn't notice it. But it was a scene that really implied that Daddy was having his way with his really attractive daughter. And I'm like, why are we adding this scene to this movie? This does nothing.
Yeah, that incest meme is a weapon. Yeah, you destroy those families with that in a heartbeat. So that's what they're really pushing now. They were pushing interracial issues, but now they're really going towards the pedophilia and the incest in their agenda. And then you read their books, you know, everything from the Talmud up through the sacred magic of Abram El and the Mage, and you realize just how dark that goes, you know, into that not only child abuse, but incest, and then you know, all the way down to the tried old tradition of ritual sacrifice, that this is part of the system. You know, it's like you may not want to believe that, but history proves it out. And, you know, what we're seeing, you know, coming out now with all this Pizzagate stuff, these people's worldview, this is what they do. This is their rules. They don't play by European white civilization rules. It's completely different morality, you know, that peculiar system of morality.
It is. It's, you know, I don't watch TV really anymore or very few movies, or I have certain things that, you know, I enjoy that go back far enough that I'll watch those. Like, I'm a real big fan of Burn Notice. I mean, I love that show. I was at some website one day and we were talking about counterintelligence. And somebody said, well, you know, was asking about, you know, how do they learn this stuff? What do you want to do? And I said, just go watch the show Burn Notice. It's like a friggin' training school.
Yes. Whoever wrote that, I've seen a few episodes of that. And, you know, it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, this, I live this. And this is how those.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, this is how it works. This is the, you know, I always talk about the five B's of the Meany method at, you know, at the Breakfast Club. It's like you bully, you bribe, you blackmail, you banish, and you bury. You know, and
well, I will tell you something about burn notice. I found out, and I was like you, who is their own set person that's giving them this stuff? You know, and I kept watching all the credits. I own the DVDs. And so I'm watching the credits, and it never ever. It would usually, like in TV shows, they'll say the guy's name, the detective or whoever who was on set, expert, you know, to help them in their procedures.
Right.
But there's never anybody listed for that position. So I finally found I can't remember the name of the guy that the guy that starred in Burn Notice. And he's also in the two movies with Sirocco about the Mexico. We got to talk about Mexico, dude. And what just happened down there? Bad news. And but anyway, he explained he was at one of those comedy things or gatherings, and he and the guy Sam, who played Sam, were doing a question and answer session with all the people in there, and somebody asked him that question. And he went and explained a lot. It was a former CIA guy, evidently. And he even gave his first name, which was Michael, too. But what he said was, a lot of that stuff, and I really wondered, did you happen to see the show where had to go steal a sniper rifle, what it turned out to be, out of a warehouse before it got delivered to the government? And they put it in the trunk, and Michael devised, he had to see it, what it was. He didn't know what it was. He didn't know what was in the trunk, in the case. And so he took an old tube TV, and he took the CTR tube out of it. He hooked it up, basically, to a real powerful taser. And cause we're going back to 2004, 2005 for this. And then when he get in the car, he pushed the taser, and he had got a piece of film. And so he was able, when the guy was forcing him to do it, and when they got separated, he was able to get the film and process it and look at it. And he saw it was a weapon. I wondered, and he said on the show, I mean, on that set, that they actually did that. That was the guy that was doing the show, a lot of this stuff they had actually done. And I'm like, holy moly, I wondered if you could actually do that. And you can. It's like, wow. I mean, these guys come up and what they can do now. So that's the other scary part. What they're capable of now is just, it's, you know, you haven't got a chance.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's, you know, if you are a targeted individual, you know, you are facing some pretty that's force multipliers, as they say.
Yeah. It's an exponential. And I'll tell you what, I have a friend that's he's an ex-sniper and military, pretty high level. Frank will know what I'm talking about. He's a scout, sniper qualification. He had his own little guys. And we were talking, and he's real wise. In fact, I will tell you this, just to let you know, his mother was Jewish, and he had studied theology and all this stuff. And so he met me, and we were talking, and he asked me a question. Like, how do you know all this shit? And he said, what's your level? And I said, John, no level, just happen to know. And so I explained to him everything that what we talk about with, like, the Holocaust, what's in the Talmud, all this stuff. And he had studied it out in California, and studied all types of religion. And he sort of like believed in Jesus. And he was sort of a Jewish. He had a big Talmud there, and he would read the Talmud was sitting out when I looked at it. But I explained to him everything that we talk about, pretty much. And he came back to me maybe 2 months later. And you know what he told me? You're not going to ever guess. He said, I no longer identify as Jewish. I'm not Jewish. He went and checked out all the Ashkenazi, the Kazarian stuff. And he found out. He said, I'm not from the tribe. And there was an article 10 years ago in the Jerusalem Post or Times. I'm not sure on which one. I've got it bookmarked. It's still there. That actually one of the head rabbis actually proclaimed that the story about Kazaria and all that stuff was true. And they really had no ties to the land, that they were Europeans. Well, Netanyahu was in power back then. And this is in the article. And it's a pretty long article from the writer. And he said Netanyahu put a kibosh on it. And he said there were lots of people that when they found that out that were living in Israel, they said, well, what the hell are we doing here? I mean, this is, you know, I thought, you know, they were sold the scam, right? So they believed that they were part of the tribe, actually. And they were wanting to leave and get out. Netanyahu wouldn't have anything with it, buried the story, cut it off, and then he passed laws that made it almost impossible for these people to exit Israel and move back to Europe.
Yeah, when you start getting into that, what I call the Maccabee mindset, you know, one of the things, when you go back to the Maccabee revolution uprising against the Greeks, under Judah Maccabee in 166 BC, you know, what was so ruthless about his guerrilla strategies of warfare was he didn't just go after the Greeks. He went after the fellow Jews who he didn't think were being true to the tribe, that they were getting a little bit too much assimilated to the Greek way of life, et cetera. And so he would go after Jews. So you had this, you know, gangland, hidden hand overlay of this whole model that, you know, once you're in, and you can never leave, you know, and if you do leave, you are dead to your people, you know, that we're either going to banish you or bury you. And so you even have things like Talmudic Mishira law, which makes it a high crime to ever expose the crimes of a fellow Jew before the Goyim. Yeah, that is a huge sin in this mindset. And so these people, you know, are, it's like we may be afraid of U.S. law enforcement, but we're more afraid of what things like the JDL, Jewish Defense League, et cetera, the ADL, SPLC, will do to us if we are deemed a self-hating Jew, Israel-threatening Jew, and get on the SHIT list, which is what they call it, self-hating Israel-threatening list. And then, you know, you not only have these JDF and stuff, but you have Mossad coming after you. You are betraying our interests. You know, you're a liability now. And that's, to me, what's so bizarre about this whole modern Maccabee world Zionism thing is, you know, that the Jews are being held captive and forced to fight, basically. A lot of them are into it, but, you know, those that aren't, you know, they just can't walk away from it, you know, from what I'm seeing.
Yeah, they can't. They prevent it. And that story outlined it pretty well. I mean, it was an actual admission. I mean, I 10 years ago, it was some major rabbi, and he said it. They've looked at it, you know, and they've confirmed that, you know, we're not, you know, we're Khazarians, you know.
When you look at, you know, so many people are doing great research now on this, and when you look at what this system of Judaism is, you know, so much of it really came into being, and, you know, when they redefined Judaism after the Knight Templars returned from digging under the Temple Mount in 1126 AD and turned over what they found to the Priory of Zion, and that turned into the Talmud and the Zohar and the Kabbalah and all this, you know, modern Judaism, that then you have the Zabbateans and the Frankist movements within that. And then, you know, of course, the Illuminati with Rothschild and Weishaupt, you know, they came out of that Sabbatean Frankist movement of this new Judaism. And there, you know, and then communism, you know, came out of that, and it's all based on the same system model, you know, and as you see how it progressed, and that people like Netanyahu, you know, Netanyahu or Bibi Netanyahu, as I call him,
yeah.
you know, he is just into this whole messianic thing that, you know, Israel's going to rule the world and he's going to be the new King David. And yeah, that when you really start listening to the, you know, Bibi Netanyahu, you know, he is a believer.
I think he believes in something. I'm not, you know, whoever this Jehovahian God is, you know, we all have our thoughts about it. And perhaps it goes back to other things that we just don't really talk about unless we're in private. It goes back to the old president. I can't remember which one it was, but that he made the statement. There's a force out there that's so powerful, one dare not speak about it above a whisper.
Yeah, yeah, that's – and FBI guy Hoover, you know, talked about, you know, the American people are faced with something so big, I'm paraphrasing, that they just – you know, it's beyond your Overton window to conceptualize it, that this is so outside of our morality, you know, that we can't even fathom – what we're up against with this hidden hand group. And he was describing the same hidden hand model. You know, it's the shadow, and that everybody's afraid of it because, you know, they are ruthless. You know, they will take you out.
So I've been told.
And, and there'll be no penalty under their law for them. You know,
no, it's a good thing.
Cattle.
Amalek. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing is like, okay, if you define yourself as a Jew, I want you to first tell me what that means. You know, I'd love to, you know, for you to explain exactly what that means, because everybody always tells me something different. And then the follow-up question is, can you describe Amalek to me? What is Amalek? You know, it is basically anybody now that's standing in the way of this Jewish world dominant system. And there you go. So it was like, oh, great. You know, not only are you a white supremacist, Nazi, whatever, tinfoil hat wearing supremacist, but you're also Amalek, you know. So it's having these other people define you suddenly, but you're the enemy.
And the other part of this is that the history that they've invented about themselves is pretty much false. In fact, you know, it's, you know, most, how many people are aware that, you know, we call them Jews, but, you know, that wasn't what they originally were called.
Yeah.
That wasn't what they were. They were called the Ooz, E-A-U-S, basically. Because the letter J didn't even get invented until like middle 17th century or something.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's just a very synthetic system. You can see what it's modeled after. You can see what their end game is. But as far as any organic rightful claim to that title, yeah, there is none. It's all synthetic. But yeah, it's this system that they have developed, and you know, you can see it. You know, we always talk about reverse engineering the New World Order. It's like, now that you see it, you get black-pilled and white-pilled and red-pilled, you know, and you see it. And so then you go back and you look at all these points in history that they didn't teach you about in public education, that you didn't see a Hollywood movie about, that isn't on the made for TV movie nights, you know, that isn't reintroduced constantly in screenplays, et cetera. You know, you put those data dots in and suddenly you get a much different picture. And you always talk about in my show in programming, you have garbage in, garbage out, or GIGO. You know, it's like you can't have a good, you know, worldview if your data set is flawed and seriously missing key data dots. And that the things they didn't tell us about line by mission is so key and just as damaging, if not more so, than the deliberate lies that they tell.
Yes, that's the big part, lying by omission, leaving out the important data.
And Americans pointing out in the chat room here, the humanitarian law is Talmudic law. Yeah, it's just Judaism is communism. It's their model. It's a centralized master-slave system. And you break it down into their seven-layer Talmudic Noahide law spectrum, that prism system. You know, and this is how they see the New World Order, with themselves in that pyramid at the top, you know, that triangle with the eye of Horus in it. You know, that's their symbol. You see that, and you were talking about earlier about the set designs. You know, you always seeing that little triangle, the 777 triangle with the eye of Horus in it. You know, that's one of their totems. And, you know, like I say, the symbolism will be their downfall.
Yeah. Yeah, it's everywhere. And once you see it, you know, you can't not see it anymore. And that's sort of the good thing. But when you try to talk to other people and point it out, it's almost like they're programmed to not. Well, they are programmed. They don't want to go down that path.
Right. And that's that cognitive dissonance thing. It's like, you know, you put these data dots in of a faulty history, and then you emotionally bond it. So it's right protected. You know, so you think, how many school children are bombarded with this, you know, mythos of the eternal innocent victim Jew through having to read Anne Frank's diary, having to read, you know, Night by Elie Wiesel, you know, having to watch Schindler's List, you know, and all these works of fiction that are highly emotional. Talk about how to stop it. How do you make these things emotional? So you program it right.
Revolution Radio,
not only with information, but with emotion to back that up. So you know, now people coming out of high school think that people like me that dare question the Holocaust are just the worst person ever. And yet Hitler is the new Haman from the Purim story of Esther. You know, he's just evil incarnate. And you know, anybody who dare looks at, you know, National Socialism is just, you know, horrible. So we're getting ready to go into Yeah, so you're listening to Mr. Woody and Mr. Frederick, a.k.a. Blackbird Dine. We'll be back here in just a minute. All right, I think, sorry about that, hitting the wrong button there. You are listening to Inside the Eye Live Dennis Fetcho, Mr. Dennis Fetcho, for those just tuning in. Is not able to join us today. And so as the tag team lineup here on Saturday is Mr. Woody and myself, Frederick C. Blackburn, a.k.a. Blackburn 9. Like to welcome everybody back here to the show. And once again, I just want to reiterate the commercial there that this is listener-sponsored radio. Please do what you can. If you still have resource, some of us had our resource taken away from us, but if you still have resource, you know, just really understand how important platforms like Revolution Radio are and independent shows like Inside the Eye Live. So do what you can to help keep these shows on the air and also networks going. So you know, definitely contribute to Revolution Radio if you can. So anyway, so we're talking before the break just about, you know, this synthetic development of what these people are calling themselves as Jews, and talking about reverse engineering the game plan, you know, their game plan back, and seeing how it works. And so welcome back, Mr. Woody. We're into hour three. So
congratulations,
take it away.
Frederick. We survived too.
We did too.
On brief notice.
and the trolls haven't shut down the Skype signal yet.
You know, we've been good boys pretty much. We have.
I thought we blew it the first 30 minutes. Like, oh, wow, no looking back now.
Yeah, my little statement to somebody said, he said it. I mean, you know, well, it's on the internet. Everybody knows it now.
There's a knock at my door. You have Mr. Blackburn. Come with us, sir. They're talking.
Don't worry, Frederick. You know their style. They won't do it now. You'll come home and have your furniture rearranged.
Yeah. You know, suddenly I will be in the Watauga Democrat, or Pravda Watauga, as we call it, suddenly becoming very depressed and shooting myself in the back of the head.
I actually came home and had that happen to me.
They had rearranged your furniture?
They had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we were here in your safe space. You know, we're watching you, and we can get to you at any time. That's the message.
Oh, it's not the only time. This goes back years. I mean, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. It goes to something else, basically. But yeah, I mean, listen, it's for real. I'm telling you.
Oh, yeah.
I got a bullet hole in my car.
Mob tactics work. You know, it's all about establishing the fear of the hidden hand, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, seriously, I got a bullet hole in my car. Yeah. It's the 223, which is, you know, because I couldn't figure it out. I didn't know. It wasn't a 45, and I knew it wasn't a 22. And then finally, when I met my Marine friend, and we started talking about all this stuff, and he told me about what they used and everything like that, I went, oh, my God. That's what it is. That fits. I took one out and went, oh, there it is. Cause I got a 15 now, an AR-15. So
yeah. So but, same size slug. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a window five. Could have been a 5.5-3, but anyway, yeah, they, for all y'all out there that you hear about this, for some of us, it's very real. And Frederick knows what I'm talking about. It's, every one of us, when we keep talking, we're taking risks. Every one of us. Because if Trump had not won, and I'm not going to get into this, but there was no other choice. Because if Hillary would have won that election, I can't tell you what would have happened in this country if she had taken office.
Oh, doesn't that keep you up at night? Yeah, think about what would have happened if she had won.
Well, a lot of us would probably not here.
Yeah, and gulags are dead, you know.
They would have started elimination. And, you know, you know who Steve Pachinik is, don't you?
Yes.
And so my buddy sort of knows him too. And because he started a lot of that stuff. And he, you know, he claims that he was part of a group of the intelligence community inside that actually pulled a soft coup, not to get Trump elected, but to make sure Hillary did not win it at the ballot box by, you know, stuffing the ballots. And what happened is that they still tried to do it, but so many people turned out for Trump in that election that the way they were setting up to steal the votes, which is sort of a way I understand it, is that, okay, somebody goes out and you cast a vote for Trump, and if somebody, you got 5 votes for Trump. Well, the way the internal, maybe you can confirm this if you know a little bit about it, but I read the story. The guy that actually broke this actually lived in Memphis and backtracked it for that lady that runs black box voting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, they'll take a piece of each vote inside. They can, in the computer, they can not disturb the vote, but take a piece of it and take 5 votes and make 1 vote and flip it to Hillary.
Exactly. You know, and I even ran into this electronic voting machine voter fraud during my election. And for those newbies out there, I had a brief political career before I got blacklisted, but I ran for North Carolina House, and I was able to show that the county, brand new, very expensive electronic voting machines, were tallying up our scores wrong, and it concerned my election that my numbers didn't match up. And so, you know, we finally proved to it, and I ended up conceding because even though we had shown voter fraud, I saw that, you know, I was not going to win against the incumbent. It was like a 4-time incumbent who would later go on to become Speaker of the House. You know, so it's like I didn't win. I acknowledged that. But there was, you know, a invalid election, and we're going on the record, but I conceded it to my opponent. And so we didn't have to do another countywide recount, which would have been, that was like the 3rd recount from this election, right? It was just insane how bad this election. That was in 2002, right? Mm-hmm. And North Carolina has just gotten worse and worse. These last elections, analysis has shown that there was something like 10% to 20% more voters than people actually authorized to vote. And you had all these George Soros NGO groups out doing any dirty trick they could to push the vote for the so-called progressive communist, whatever you want to call them, you know, traitor candidates that were complete puppets, and get rid of all the old, especially white male, straight white male leadership in the nation, and especially in North Carolina. We just had a voter coup d'etat the last few elections, especially, you know, since 9/11. And so much of it goes back to these electronic voting machines where it's, you know, black box. You know, you don't get to see the source code in this. And so they can be doing anything. And then, you know, counties that don't even have a paper trail of the real ballots, you know, it really, you know, you're black box voting. They're putting in whoever they want.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what this guy did in Memphis. He worked for the Election Commission in Shelby County, which is where Memphis is at. And he understood the system. And what his approach was like he just looked at it. So he had access to it. He said, okay, if I was going to try to steal an election and I didn't want it to be traced, he didn't go into the machines and try to find what they did. He actually developed his own, he actually figured out how to do that on his own and make it hidden inside the machine so nobody could really see it. And he sent it to her and said, here's how they're doing it. This is exactly, I mean, it probably is, because that's, he said he didn't try to find it. He developed a system that would do what everything would be done using the voting machine program that he had control of.
Exactly. And, you know, you look at it as mathematics. You know, you're basically doing mathematical manipulations within a programming looping, you know, read input and do this to it. But, you know, what you're doing to it is not just simple adding it to this column A here. You're doing this artificial intelligence manipulation. So this is another aspect of artificial intelligence where you're manipulating a voting for a preset agenda. It's like, yeah, this is the outcome. Now make everything work towards that. We want this person to win by this percentage in this district, so that no matter what happens on the input side, that's going to be the output. So it's, you know, the trick is to make it look feasible, look plausible. And you notice that the same time this is changing in our voting is all the Jewish media suddenly doesn't do exit polling anymore. And one of the things about elections, exit polling is usually very accurate information. Yeah, people will either say, I don't want to tell you who I voted for, but most likely they're going to tell you who they voted for. And that was, you know, very accurate and for, you know, data to compare the vote results with the polling results. Now everybody said, we're not doing exit polling, but they will have their own special polls that are saying that, you know, Hillary's going to win by 98%. And they just keep repeating this. It goes back to the Project Veritas expose of CNN. I don't know if you saw President Trump trolling CNN last night, but sending out this videotape of all the projections CNN made about how badly he was going to lose to Hillary. And it was all based on, you know, they just made it up. There was no factual base of any of those polls they're referencing. And it's, you know, as valid as when you see something from Rita Katz in Cite Memory. It's like, oh God, you know, they're citing her. That's a red flag. You know, or Snopes or something like that, you know, or the ADL, the SPLC is their expert. And so you see this massive Bolshevik tactics of, you know, electioneering. And yeah, they used to hang people in this republic for messing with elections.
Yeah, they did. You know, and when you can't trust your elections, I mean, it's really all over. I mean, and every other country, and Canada still votes by ballot, I believe, by written paper, and they get it done in a night. You know, there's this thing that we have to have the machine so we know immediately who's going to win. That's the way they explain it. It's like, no, we don't. we can't get it changed. They've got such control over all the processes in the government. It's like the 79 guys that Republicans that jumped ship, you know, and voted with the Democrats over pulling out of Syria. I mean, look, you know, everybody used to think that Syria changed topics. Everybody used to think Syria and all that was about a pipeline. Well, that's not what it was about. It's about that little piece of land you see them arguing over right now. That's what it's been about the whole time. It's not about the pipeline over there. And I, you know, a certain person that I talked to said, no, it's about that little stretch of land right in there and who owns it. And you saw immediately Turkey moved in and tried to take it over. And it's nothing really to do with, listen, Syria, oil, really, how much oil do they have? I mean, just not that much, really. And the whole system is completely rigged now, it seems like. And there seems to be no way out, except if everybody is expecting the grid to fail here soon. With maybe a false flag is what I'm hearing. In fact, there's a guy that I sort of follow, and he's called the Health Ranger. He comes on Alex Jones and everything, but he's a really smart guy, and he has this laboratory, and he does all this work. And he said he went to a conference, and all these first responder people are there, and, you know, all government agencies, all these first responders, people for planning for disasters, all these people are there, this thing that he's attending. And he said when he left, a lot of these people who work for the government came up and told him and said, listen, you know, they knew who he was. They said, listen, we want to talk to you. This is his story. He said they told him that they were all working and being trained currently, and all the stuff that they're doing is for like major disasters in certain cities that they're going to spring this on. That's going to be the chaos that they're going to open up. And a lot of it is bringing down the grids in cities. And that would be so easy to do. It would be extremely easy to do, because all you got to do is take out the main power plant area, not the transformers and all. And, you know, every town's got one. And then the substations, you take out that main one, that's it. And a little piece of information, we'll say, well, they'll just fix it and they'll bring in a new one. That's not going to happen. When I'm one of those, it takes a year from the time you put in the order to have one of those things built and put together for you in a city. A year from the time you put it in, and then build one at a time.
Yeah.
That will, with the kids on the phones and all this, can you imagine what will happen with pulling that drug device away from them?
Yeah,
they will go nuts, and they will get it.
What would happen if you had a complete shutdown? He goes, "What's your plan B, and what is the society going to do?" And I think, you know, you cut off your communication, cut off your electricity. We're seeing rolling blackouts in California right now. Like, oh my gosh, you know, California is now South Africa, and you know, you think you are the big shifts in the rainbow nation of South Africa is. Used to, South Africa had one of the most stable energy grids and communication grids on the planet. It was a first-rate world country. I mean, just everything ran as it was supposed to. It was very well engineered, very well managed. And, you know, since the communists have taken over, it's completely unreliable. Everybody has to have their own backup generators, and your communications are constantly going out in South Africa. Now we're seeing that in California.
Yeah. And someone told me that evidently lives out there, maybe you've heard it too, is that this is a bunch of crap. They said there's not these winds, there's not these situations. They don't understand why they're doing it. And today I just went to Drudge, which is totally worthless now. Not that it was great before, but I mean, it's really just like polls constantly. 51% of the people, you know, want impeachment on Trump. I'm like, that's so bogus. I mean, you can't even really. But they don't believe. They believe that it's a test. They actually think that maybe, you know, this is a government, you know, test to see how the people react, what they do, how they, you know, how they respond to it. But then today on Drudge, just before went on the air, I opened it up and it said that PG&E has now told them they think they're going to have to do this for 10 years.
Oh, we got a 10-year model on the floor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's the new normal. You know, that's part of this new system is normalizing the abnormal. And you think of after the Bolsheviks seized Russia and all of this, you know, the Eastern European countries, where you know, you went from these cities that were moving into the industrial age modernization to just total chaos and unreliability of the system. You think how bad the Soviet Union was before it collapsed of just trying to get any type of resource, like, you know, stable energy, stable food in the grocery stores, et cetera.
Yes. And you take away the gas pumps and not availability to pump gas. Cause I've been through situations where I'm in a city that we've lost power for well over 2 weeks to a month, major city. And that happened in Memphis a couple of times from ice storms and what we called Hurricane Elvis, which was straight line of winds that took down huge amounts of oak trees and power lines. The first thing that you noticed was that you couldn't get gas and no traffic lights worked when you went out. You had to be really careful, but all the gas stations were shut down. You couldn't even do business because the cash registers weren't working, but they couldn't run the pumps. Even if they had gas, they had no way to run the pumps. They don't have backup generators.
Right. When I went through Hurricane Fran, when I was still living in Raleigh, North Kakalaki, Fran came when we were without power for 10 days in downtown Raleigh. And basically, trees were down, power was out. You couldn't get on the roadways. You had to work your way out with a chainsaw, and like you said, the grocery stores were shut down. Lots of price gouging, especially from all these Pakistani Indian stores. Suddenly, they're price gouging, and it's like we don't do that here. And then we didn't see the looting in the majority place. So a few stores reported having their ice machines broken into, but nothing major looting like what you see now in South Africa or even what we saw in Louisiana after that hurricane going through New Orleans. Just all the looting and chaos there.
Yes. Yeah. We didn't have that here when it started. I'm sure there was some in certain neighborhoods. You know, they took advantage. But overall, most everybody, you know, took it calmly and it worked out. But you always knew the power was coming back. You just didn't, because it was slowly coming back in certain areas. But it took me 3 weeks before I got it back. And that's a long time. But I had a generator. I've had a generator ever since 1999, just on the case that 2000 was going to be right. And I didn't think it was, but I wasn't going to get caught in the open. And I had a business and I needed the generator for what I was doing then anyway. I said, okay, so I pulled the trigger. You know, it was like $2,000, you know, back then, because now you can buy the same generator for like $400 or $500. And so I was able to get through it. But there's a guy that I follow now. He's an ex-CIA officer that is a true whistleblower called Kevin Shipp. And he's like class one, former 7th floor type of guy. And he's doing videos now. He's in a farm down somewhere. I'm pretty sure it's in Georgia, in that Georgia Northern Mountains, pretty remote. And he did a video on, you know, having a generator. You need a generator and all this stuff. And he showed the little shed he built for it. And I wrote him. I said, Kevin, I said, that's all good and all. But if the power goes down, the way you've got that generator, and think about this, folks, the way you've got that generator, yeah, it's in that building. It's protected from the weather, but it's loud as hell. And anybody, when they're you're running that generator and somebody hasn't got power, they're going to come looking for your generator, and they're going to hear it, and they're going to follow you right to it. You've got to learn how to blimp them. And blimping is what we use in the movies. It's a big-ass generator, but you can hardly hear it. That's because inside that big container in there, they put soundproofing in it. So we can use it without interfering. It's got to be a certain distance away without interfering with the audio of the movies. So anybody that you've got a generator, you need to think about how you can soundproof it. And what they basically do, you build a pretty good container around it, shed, whatever, and then fill it with insulation. Just your old plain regular pack, pull it in the walls and in the ceiling and everywhere, and leave a vent at the top and a place at the bottom for air. And that will cut the sound level down to still going to hear it, but it's not going to be anywhere near is what it was.
You're not broadcasting your position. And like you say, when you get into that level of game theory where people suddenly everything's haves and have nots. And what was the line about there are 9 mils between civilization and chaos. And that's one of the things you go through in these kind of situations where you have people that plan for this, that are prepared for this. It is just an inconvenience, but you know, their lives don't really get turned completely upside down from it. But then you have the people that they're living meal to meal. They don't have the cognitive ability to plan ahead. You know, they just don't understand the concept of time, but they understand that they're hungry and they're upset and something's changed to them. And there's that person over there that has stuff and they don't have it and it's not fair. And so they're going to go over there and take what they want. And when you have a generator broadcasting, you know, I've got power, I've got power. If I got power, I probably have food. You know, so you know,
yes,
things. And but you know, when you're soundproofing generators, like you said, you've got to be real careful about not restricting your intake line for the air and also your exhaust. You don't want to die from carbon monoxide poisoning by being in the shed with your generator because it's just, you know, filling up the room with carbon monoxide. You got to be able to vent that, but that you can't compromise your soundproofing when you're venting it.
No, no. And it's, you know, it's something to remember is all I'm saying, because, you know, there a lot of the generators did get stolen from people when we had these big power outages, because like you said, people don't care at that point. They've got kids or maybe they have a baby and they got to heat the formula. You know what? You, me, anybody put in that situation is going to go look and find any way they can to fix that major problem that they have.
Exactly. You've got this immediate need, and so you're going to go into need fulfillment. And you know, how do you take care of these people on your list that you're in charge of taking care of? Like you said, you know, children, et cetera. You know, you're going to go out and try to make it right. And the question is, how does that fit in with what everyone else is doing? And so it's individual needs and system needs. And when the system starts breaking down, you know, then you start having your anarchy problems. And you know, suddenly you're into a Lord of the Flies situation. And keeping the social order. Part of that is the social contract, that you're agreeing to not break into total anarchy, that you have faith in the system, that the system will come back up. But at what point do you realize you're on your own? And ain't nobody going to come to help you, and what you have is what you have. These are the only force multipliers you have. You've got this much water. You got this much toilet paper. You got this much food. You've got a toilet that is either functioning or not functioning. You know, you have this much communications, and just keep going up. It's like, you know, how are your bills going to get paid? They're going to keep accruing. How are you going to pay them if you're cut off? And then, you start getting into trouble because you can't, pay your bills because you didn't get paid. You weren't able to get to work. And now you come after your vehicle, you know, just got damaged, you know, how can it get repaired? All those needs come into play in these emergency situations. And like we always say at the Breakfast Club, life comes at you fast. You know, you've got to stay awake and be ready.
Yes. And this guy, Mike, I can't remember his last name, the health ranger, Pachinik likes it. Of course, Pachinik also with his brother owns a supplement company where they make some pretty high level stuff there for, instead of, you know, regular drugs made from petroleum. He said that they sort of imply with him, whether it's true or not, but keep your windows open, and pay attention because, Antifa is going to be at the heart of it. And they're going to start doing this stuff in certain cities, he said. This is what the people are telling him that they're training for, to, you know, go in and take over the cities and everything when the chaos starts, when they start taking down, you know, power lines, grids, maybe the whole damn thing if they can get to it. That you, it's going to start probably in the spring, is what he said, is what they told him. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. I'm just passing it along. I'm looking at it. But one thing that I have noticed, I wrote something the other day. I said, anybody seen Antifa lately? Not really. There was a little bit here and a little bit there after some Trump rallies, but it's not the Antifa we're used to. They're not dressed up and they don't have their weapons. The word is that, they're actually in training to learn to actually, I still learn a certain type of martial arts. And when I watch these guys with these long sticks that they're using or anything they use as a weapon, they're absolutely pitiful. I mean, anybody with any training is just going to annihilate them immediately. And they're now training them. And I actually went online and found some videos of them out teaching them. Basically, it's a mixed martial arts type of system, which is, you know, not my favorite. I mean, I studied Jeet Kune Do, which is where that came from, but their method of training, it's very sloppy. And most mixed martial arts schools are, because you're in a ring and it's not like Jason Bourne type fighting is really what you need to learn how to do.
Here, the Antifa, we were talking about Appalachian State University earlier, and it's been completely compromised and weaponized into this Antifa, LGBT, New World Order, Globo Homo brainwashing center. And there's a group of Antifa here that have started Krav Maga martial arts classes.
Good luck with that.
The Israeli, any means necessary. There's no such thing as a fair fight. You win by any means necessary.
Well, that's in all martial arts. I mean, if you get to the higher level. I mean, mainly study Kali, and it's like biting, scratching, pulling eyes out. When you're in a fight, everything and everything goes.
Right, and that's the thing is, you know, you got to, when you're at this level of hell levels, you know, it's definitely kill or be killed or, you know, immobilize, you know, but, you know, you are in a life-threatening situation. You have to behave accordingly. And that's I study Taekwondo and Kung Fu here and also Martin Arnis with the stick fighting and also Bo.
That's Kali.
Okay, so Martin Arnis is Kali, the same kind of thing? Yeah.
Yeah, Kali, Arnis, Eskrima. Yeah, that's Filipino. Well, there's some in Indonesia, but it's Filipino.
Right. And, you know, you get to those low levels and it's just, you know, you've got to defend yourself and defend what you're defending, you know, be it your family, your children, your spouse, whatever. But you know, your life comes at you fast. And one of the things, driving home yesterday in the chaos for homecoming weekend. And so there's the homecoming weekend at the university. You've got all of these gangsta thugs coming up from like Charlotte and the surrounding areas for the big parties at ASU this weekend. And I was, you know, coming home and a car pulled up beside me and they were just, you know, it was one of those where you could hear it before you saw it. And in the corner of my eye, I saw this black guy with dreads had his fingers doing this pistol thing. But yeah, because they were jamming out to their tunes as they were, you know, cruising around before the big party started this weekend. But it's just that split second of, is this about to get real? Because, you know, I saw somebody in, you know, that peripheral vision that was making a pistol sign. And it's like, you know, at what point do, you know, that's a common tactic is, yeah, you sucker punch somebody at an intersection. You just drive up and you, you know, shoot. And right. That's one of the first defenses you learn when you're a driver is, you know, they're going to try to take out the driver first. If you're, you know, in that kind of situation. And so it's like that, you know, what point is this, you know, Chicago here in the little sleepy town of Boone, North Kakalaki, you know, because of this, you know, anti-white gangsta anarchy type mindset where they're just trying to come, go out and have random violence, you know, the ultra violence for the sake of violence. To, you know, this is a psychological warfare type system.
Yes. Yeah, I agree totally. You know, it's when we start getting, when it goes to that level where it's starting to bring out actual weapons, but they are going to, but the good news is this, for where you live, what they said was, is that they were going to only do it in the major cities, in certain major cities, but they wouldn't tell him which ones. Maybe they don't even know, according to him. But he said, if you, and it was funny, his words were, he said, like, if you live in the, like, you know, like the middle of Tennessee, you know, or somewhere like that, not, you know, in between big open areas, in between, you know, the, like Nashville and Knoxville, he said, you're probably going to be okay. He said, it's going to be the cities. And you can always, you can probably look around and see which ones they're going to use based on their racial population and the number of liberals that are in them. So,
Charlotte, North Carolina, it's amazing how much Charlotte, North Carolina has changed since 9/11. It is complete demographic replacement and chaos theory there. And it's like the new Atlanta. I think they've, you know, picked Atlanta early on, New Orleans after Katrina, especially, you know, New Orleans is a sad place right now. And Atlanta is just insane. And I think, you know, Charlotte, definitely Chicago, you think of all the chaos and, you know, gun safe Chicago. It's bad enough under Rahm Emanuel, Echo, but this new person they've got in is just, yeah, she's a piece of work.
She's nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I lived in Charlotte when I was a kid. Probably that's been 40, 50 years ago. I grew up in North Carolina, a lot of North Carolina. In fact,
yes, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I lived in Atlanta before I moved to Memphis, and I've been back a few times. I want, right now on the coast, I used to sometimes take the train down to New Orleans and then scoot on over to either rent a car or sometimes I had to start renting cars because I couldn't stand riding Greyhound anymore. It was just, good God. So it was a 2-hour drive, but it was just 2 hours out of hell. And New Orleans, I just don't even want to go there anymore. I mean, Bourbon Street is it's a cesspool. I mean, you got men walking around half naked, like before the even stuff we've got now, transvestite, girls outside the bars now, you know, completely topless, wearing G-strings, trying to get the guys to come in or the women. And kids, all these folks have got their kids in their hands, you know?
Oh, yeah. People bring their children to these things. It's like the Pride March in Atlanta. Like, we just didn't have a Pride Month. You know, now we have to have special Pride Day in Atlanta. And Delta Airlines is right on top of it. Just, you know, we got to have that diversity and that pride and, you know, just all this corporate sponsorship of this from things like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, et cetera. U.S. Bank, you know, they're all behind this LGBT PCQ agenda, and, you know, pushing it, and that, you know, they are targeting the white population. They want you destroyed. And so these are bioweapons here, and not just, the images coming out for the Pride Parade and that people bringing their children to this is up there with the, the drag queen story hours in the public libraries.
That's unbelievable. I cannot believe people. I mean, it's like someone said, I saw the video. This guy's up there, big fat guy with a beard, in his drag queen outfit, does a strip tease for these kids.
Yeah. And it's like, how is this educational? Well, it's educational, but is this really?
You wouldn't let a woman come in there.
Normalized to our children. Yeah.
You wouldn't put a real woman to come in there and do a strip tease. You wouldn't let a real guy come in there and do it. But somehow it's okay to send this piece of garbage in there to a pedophile.
Yeah. And, these guys, we keep exposing them that these guys are convicted pedophiles that are doing this. But yet somehow they get past that screening. Nobody's vetting them because they're afraid that they'll be called names and lose their jobs for being discriminatory. If they vet these people and say, we don't want you in our venue, we don't want you in, doing this because you don't meet our requirements. We think you're a threat to the safety of the children. But, nobody's going to say that. That would be, intolerant.
So, yeah, right.
Can't have that.
I got your intolerance right here. Get tolerant. It's just so bizarre. I mean, I sit back and I look at it and I'm going, how in the hell those of us that were awake, we've seen it for years, but yet this stuff comes out and the people still are not barking. It's starting to be a little bit now. They're going to the schools and trying to pull their kids out because they're even, making the laws where you can't take your kids out and they have to be there and experience this and all this stuff. And the parents, most of them they're going along with it. And
also, I just think what a large percentage of children in public schools now are at best from a single parent home, much less, a lot of them are in, state orphanages in the system now where they've been taken from the parents for whatever reason, and placed in foster care. And so who is going to advocate for these children if the parents have been taken out of the equation? And that's part of the cultural Marxist model, the Illuminati, they all say we're going to destroy not only Christianity, we're going to destroy all nations, but we're going to destroy the family unit. And the state will raise the children. And the state as the primary caregiver. And that was the big thing of the Bolshevik communist model was, the state raising the children. And now you see, well, what do we have here? Mandatory education in this indoctrination center. And I see Appalachian State University started out as a teacher's college for the people of this Appalachian mountain to go to learn to be teachers. And so now it's full university and they are still training teachers, but what they're training them is to be little Antifa foot soldiers. Like actually on the webpage now, it tells that the Appalachian State is all about creating global citizens. And, the person, Jezebel Everett, the chancellor who came in after 9/11, her whole agenda was to make Appalachian State University as diverse as possible. And the first thing she did was come in and purge all the old white guys, the old Christian white guys that have been at the university forever. All the locals are purged. Locals can't get a job at the university, and they're just filling it with all these, people from other nations and, non-whites that are anti-whites and taking part in this, anti-local agenda here. That they're declaring war on the locals but claiming the intellectual, moral, ethical high ground at the same time. That we're right and you locals are wrong, and we're here to tikkun olam you, we're gonna fix you. So she's here to fix the white problem. And the same thing with all our media. Adams Publishing, out-of-state carpetbaggers, and if you remember Stephen Adams, Adams Publishing, his father, Cedric Adams, made his career for CBS doing war propaganda. You know, he was out there in the voice of the Midwest convincing all those German, you know, immigrant nationals and Polish nationals, we need to get into this war, World War II. That's where his daddy got his start. He's skull and the Stephen's skull and bones. And so he's bought up all the media in these Appalachian Mountains, the local media, and just moving in these Jewish editors from New York. So it's like, why does Watauga County's main newspaper of record, why do we need a Jewish editor who's never seen? He never writes anything. He's like the Jeff Zucker at CNN, you know, that he just sends out the marching orders at 9 a.m. during the editor meeting. And it's like, this is what you're going to focus on. And it's nothing but the LGBT, globo homo, New World Order agenda. And, girl power, black power, you name it. Yeah, that's what they focus on, and everybody else gets censored. I'm actually censored, banned from my own local newspaper, not because of, their term of service, agreement is the same old thing as, Facebook and all these other terms of service, but it's like I did not break it. They just didn't like what I was saying, so they banned me, with no reprieve. I can't appeal this editorial decision to ban me from my own local newspaper. But, they're out there just doing, marketing, and it's just they're selling this model, and it's all about the clergy plan to destroy the community, destroy the family, destroy Christianity in the name of education, progress, and sustainability. And they, think they're the ultimate social justice warriors. They're just so smug and proud of themselves for, being out there fighting the good fight like good little Antifa foot soldiers, It's maddening.
It is maddening. I have a bunch of friends. I lived here so long in Memphis, and when I came back into town, we've been playing cards together since college, every Sunday night, and they still do it. And I came back, and they talked me into coming over. I hadn't played in probably 5-6 years with them. I just quit playing. And so I went over there, and to my shock, I mean, these are all college educated guys, pretty much, and, now we all grew up. I wasn't where I am now. Back in the, back in the earlier days, I didn't care much for Reagan. The politics were a little bit different, because we were against the Vietnam War and, because we all knew what it was. So I showed up at the card game, and every one of those guys at the table were just like, they wanted Hillary to win. They thought Trump, they were totally clueless. They listened to CNN and those national networks, and that's where they get all their news from. They don't do any alternative media and look at the other side. And it was like being in the Twilight Zone.
It's like the invasion of the body snatchers. It's like if you have such a different worldview, I can't relate to you right now, and you refuse to see the truth. And it's that cognitive dissonance glaze over, it's like Orange Man bad NPC character.
That's the way they were talking.
Yeah.
Oh, we can't get Trump, and we ought to just throw him in the ocean,
I think we should protest.
they had nothing to back it up. They just bought this meme. They listen to CNN and they take it as it's true, as it's there's not another side to the story, and they never look for one, which was like my best friend was that way. I mean, he and I, voracious readers back in those days and reading all kinds of different books, and he's bought into it. I mean, it's like, I told him, I said, listen, you just cannot discuss politics around me. You just can't do it because we are so far apart that, I just don't want to hear it. And I'll have to be, I'm not going to sit there at this table with you guys playing cards and listen to this bullshit because you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
clue about the facts.
Yeah, you're just parroting to sound clever and informed. I always like the old adage that if you don't read newspapers, you're uninformed. So if you don't read a newspaper, you're uninformed. but if you read newspapers, you're misinformed. You know, my favorite is when people say, well, I heard on NPR or on PBS. It's like, oh, that's even worse than CNN. It's, yeah, they are just so smug in their intellectualism. And here, our PBS stations, our so-called public television stations, which are operated in North Carolina through the university system, we got into a row because I was trying to get them to air in 2012 the Architects and Engineers documentary on explosive evidence, and because the PBS station out in Colorado had aired it. And so we were trying to get our public television station to air it. And suddenly I'm running into Jew after Jew after Jew after Jew who are making all the content editorial decisions for the public television stations and public radio stations, NPR in North Carolina. And it's just like I'm starting to see a pattern here between a certain religious group and 9/11 truth. And you know, they not only did they refuse to show it, but you know, got these scathing, you know, how dare you, how dare you, you know,
my childhood.
From these editors that would be implying our government and we are the root of integrity in journalism, and so we're not going to deal with such preposterous claims and such that. And it's like, this is science. You know, you're the university. I went through all your physics classes, you know, and you should be at the vanguard of this. You know, why are you not leading the charge rather than handling, you know, censoring the truth? And so that's that huge thing about, you know, oh my gosh, you know, they not only control the corporate media, but the taxpayer funded media as well. You know, they have put their people in all these key positions. They're playing the long game. It's like, oh my gosh.
Yes. Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Here in Memphis, I used to do a lot of side work for the NPR station here. And, you know, it wasn't so bad back then, but now it's, I can't even turn it on anymore, especially the national. But going back just briefly, you talked about how the Jews come forward. I can't remember the guy's name. He's got like a TV show on cable. I think he had it on network and they kicked him off because he's pro-Trump. But he's not now. He was ranting yesterday because Trump pulled the troops out of Syria. Actually, I don't think it was that many fighting troops. I heard it was like just a basically about 150 special ops.
I heard it was less than that. Yeah, it was
yeah.
A minuscule number. It's like, okay, why is all this pomp and circumstance over this minimal number of troops? But anyway, go ahead.
So he was on the thing and he was talking about, and he's Jewish. I can't remember his name, but he's famous now. I can't think of his name. He was just ranting and raving yesterday about Trump, you know, doing this horrible thing about pulling these people out of Syria. Well, he's Jewish. The Jews now, I mean, it's like, and then you notice that Trump has like turned his back on Netanyahu.
That's an interesting development. This is interesting. And, you know, especially after the elections, you know, those elections in Israel did not go well for Bibi Netanyahu.
And Trump didn't endorse him. He gave him a mild endorsement, if that, and Netanyahu had to go begging to do it.
Exactly. Well, we just got a couple of minutes left to wrap up here. So
we got 3 minutes.
I just want to tell the good folks here on a Saturday afternoon.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, go have a good afternoon, folks. Don't worry about anything and then keep your ear to the ground. I am part Native American, by the way.
Oh, okay. So, go ahead.
No. We've got this country. We're all sitting back and we can see something there. The water's simmering. It's the way I would put it. And it's just, I don't see anybody trying to turn down the flame. All I see is people trying to turn up the flame. And everybody that I know pretty much that's less like tuned in and maybe ex-military, a lot of them, they don't see a way out. They don't see a way out. And they've gone to their hidey holes. are, you know, grouping together in certain places. Some of them in Tennessee, there's, you know, Missouri up around the stuff there. And they've got their contacts. And like the guy there, everybody, and I'm like it too. I don't know if this is working anymore to try to inform people of what's about to happen, because they don't want to hear it. Yep. And I've gone to my position is, then you're not going to hear it from me anymore.
Pretty much. As it was in the time of Noah, people just keep going about their business and all of a sudden life comes at you fast.
So yeah. And you're not going to be prepared. It's going to be
like we say at the Breakfast Club, you know, wake up, level up, and party up. Anyway, so you've been listening to Inside the Eye Live, this with Mr. Woody and me, Frederick C. Blackburn, a.k.a. Blackburn 9. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on this Saturday afternoon. I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. And Godspeed to Mr. Dennis Fecho out there, our international man of mystery, secret squirrel. And I hope he's doing okay and hope to hear his adventures on Thursday. And until next time, I'll see you all at the rendezvous.
Drive it like you stole it.
Sounds good.
Enjoyed it, Frederick. It was fun.
Enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, man.
Good night.
Good day.
Good day.
Right back after this message.
Come on, music.